We'll start today's Boston Public Radio with politics as the Comey firing fallout continues and is Beacon Hill about to speak the T word again, taxes. Then the president has threatened to cancel press briefings, with most media saying there's little truth there anyway. We'll ask you, would it matter? I think it would. Then at noon, it's Ground Truth's Charlie Sennett as ransomware runs wild, North Korea launches again, and the president prepares for his first overseas trip.
Homeboy, novel-writing superstar Dennis Lehane on his latest Boston-based book, a page-turner about a Boston Globe journalist turned TV star. As we approach the 100th anniversary of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's birth, his nephew and historian Doug Brinkley with an amazing tale of his political life. Then we open the lines and ask you, some cafes are actually ditching Wi-Fi in favor of face-to-face customer chat. Really? Who wants that? And then our TV man, Bob Thompson. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Are you good? Are you
I'm
good?
Fine. Thank you for asking. So a week ago today, this is unbelievable, it was a week ago. A week ago today, Sally Yates testified in front of a Senate committee that she had warned the White House counsel that Michael Flynn was compromised by the Russians. And before we could even process that, President Trump fired James Comey. He then contradicted his own staff as to why he fired Comey. And along the way, he had a closed meeting with Russia's foreign minister. He claimed that he invented the phrase, prime the pump. And he literally scooped Time magazine during a dinnertime interview by having the White House serve him twice as much ice cream as anyone else at the table. I love that piece of the Time story. Joining us to go over the political reverberations of what could be the most action-packed week yet in Trump's presidency are Steve Kerrigan and Mike Astrew. Steve is former CEO of the DNC. He's currently the president and co-founder of Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund. Mike's a former commissioner of the Social Security Administration, working both the Bush and Obama administrations. He also writes poetry under the pseudonym A.M. Juster. Good to see you both, gentlemen.
Nice to be,
to be here.
Well, great to see you both, as usual. Mike, I'll start with you. There was a great piece in, by Charles Sykes, the former Wisconsin radio talk show host, conservative guy, talking about how...
He's former?
Yeah, I don't think he's doing it
Oh,
anymore.
I didn't know that. Okay, I'm sorry.
Let me double check.
No, but go ahead.
Former, yes,
okay.
A former.
I didn't know that.
Made me nervous, Jim. Okay. Anyway.
I think we're out of time now.
That if liberals hate Donald Trump, they must be doing something right. And he talks about how the conservative press is portraying the firing of Comey as a wonderful thing. And they're making fun of all the liberals' heads exploding over Donald Trump. Which brings us to someone whose head does seem to be exploding a little bit. He is a liberal. But he's a very smart guy. Lawrence Tribe, constitutional law scholar.
He'll be here Thursday,
Harvard
by the
law
way.
School, who's going to be here Thursday. He wrote, and I assume Charles Sykes would say this is liberal hysteria, but he did have a piece in the Washington Post and USA Today today saying it's time to impeach Donald Trump. Is Larry Tribe hysterical?
Worse than that. He was my constitutional law professor.
Was he?
And I'm also 2-0 against him in the Supreme Court. Not that we're keeping track.
And by the way, we should add you were associate general counsel to Reagan in the first Bush.
Right,
To add to your resume there. But go ahead.
You know, Larry's been losing it. He actually first called for impeachment, I believe, like 2 days after the election. And he's just off in wacko land about the Emoluments Clause and that type of thing. Because quite frankly, under his standard, John F. Kennedy should have been impeached.
What did he do?
Because the Kennedy family owned Merchandise Mart. It was an international, very profitable international company with a lot of ties. Occasionally, it got Ted Kennedy into some ethical questions in the media in the 80s.
How about obstruction of justice? Forget emoluments for a moment. How about the obstruction of justice issue?
Well, I think that it's cut close enough that it's perfectly appropriate for Congress to investigate and try to figure out what happened. Right now, you got sort of a he said thing. It's confusing. I don't think it's open and shut. But Tribe has made up his mind a long time ago. He's totally undermined his credibility. Nobody should pay any attention to Larry Tribe whatsoever.
Good. So he'll be a Thursday. Don't tune into that segment.
Before we said hello.
Before we get to
and tell him he should be a little nicer to his students while I was here. Yeah.
Before we get to Steve Kerrigan's responses, part of the argument for the obstruction of justice case. There are a bunch of them. One that in what is was a de facto job interview with Comey at that dinner when he sought a pledge of loyalty. Some say that's obstruction of justice. But the thing that I think it turned the tribes and some Democrats in Congress on was this response. Remember, we were told that the reason for Comey's firing was because of how mean he had been to Hillary Clinton. And then Donald Trump said this to Lester Holt from NBC, which sort of changed the ballgame.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won.
Are you angry with Mr. Comey because of his Russia investigation?
I just want somebody that's competent.
So are you with Tribe or are you with Astro on this, Steve Kerrigan?
I am probably with neither.
Look,
I believe there are plenty of things that the president has done, and I frankly think the Emoluments Clause is something that is worth analyzing. But for the sake of time, we'll just stick with obstruction of justice. I mean, he openly admits that he fired the FBI director, despite all the, you know, 1 hour worth of planning that his comms staff had to blame it on the deputy attorney general, who, by the way, was planning the doing the Russian investigation. He openly fires the guy, admits that he did it because of Russia, and then he threatens. I don't know if there's a new word for Twitter threats, but Twitter, I don't know, we can come up with one.
Twets.
Perfect. Thank you.
Twets.
He threatens him.
I think it's actually Twets is what it is.
He threatens him.
Twets.
openly and says, you know, you better hope that there's no tapes out there. I mean, the guy can't even threaten people, right, without exposing himself to more risk. Because I just think that Congress has to take time, because if they do try to, you know, even lean toward articles of impeachment, first of all, Republicans have to be on board. Democrats need to have their case very, very clear, because our country, frankly, an impeachment is not something we should throw around lightly. And our Congress should know what they're doing before they do it, and they rarely do.
By the way, I just to defend myself here, every time anyone on the show, Mike Astor, this is directed to you, has brought up impeachment in the 100 and whatever it is days, I've said this is ridiculous. Even on the emoluments front, where there may be technical violations, until the Holt interview and until this Comey, I'm not suggesting Congress have the House start voting tomorrow, but I think, you know, I try to be objective here. When I've forgotten this thing about you better hope there are no tapes. This is to the head of the FBI, who is leading the investigation into possible Russian connection. That's pretty close to obstruction of justice,
isn't
it? Yeah,
I think this is one of those rare occasions, Jim, where you and I are in substantial agreement. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing about – or not the weird thing. One of the many weird things about this is that this is another case of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
If they had simply done this by the book, and the book would have said – you know, the day before the inauguration, the chief of staff calls up James Comey and says, thank you for your service. We'd like your resignation with all the other Obama appointees who are resigning tomorrow. And then he made a statement saying, we thank him for his service. But quite frankly, both sides of the aisle have lost confidence in him, and we need to have full confidence in FBI. He would have been applauded. I mean, you have to remember, it's in that context, Mrs. Clinton was still out there on a daily basis hammering away at James Comey.
No, I agree. There would have been some blowback, but nothing like this.
Ultimately, he would have come across as presidential, and it would have been a plus. And he's taken something that should have been simple and straightforward, and it's turned into a political and PR disaster for him.
But I would say this goes to – I totally agree with you, by the way. It would have gotten lost a little bit. There would have been some blowback, but in the inaugural flurry, it would have been lost and all. Mm-hmm. He can't also – that he's so narcissistic that even the reasoning that his own team gave didn't give him enough credit for making the decision. So he had to go out and say, no, Trump and his third person referencing himself is just a little ridiculous.
But he's not alone in that. It drives
me. No, I know.
A lot of politicians both parties do. It drives me nuts.
But as the Democrats said during the campaign, as Hillary said, if you can bait him with a tweet, I mean, this guy gets baited into taking the blame for more things than he really should.
I don't know if you're aware, if the election was October 27th, she would have won. Did you know that? Or you probably hadn't heard that?
Believe me.
Maybe
well aware of that. There's a lot of elections I'd like to move back a little earlier.
We're still going to Steve Kerrigan and Mike Astor.
But he may be the first president that's giving everybody pictures of the electoral map that comes to visit him
constantly.
In the Oval Office that I read today in the New York Times. It has a big.
Like, I mean, there's a seal on the rug. Like,
yeah.
He knows he won, right? Like,
can we go back to Comey for a second?
He goes on Fox News and keeps talking about ratings.
I 95% agree with you, Mike Astor, that if he had done it in a different way at a different time, there would have been very little blowback. Jeffrey Toobin, who I think had the only correct response early on CNN when these sad CNN justice reporters were saying, oh, the investigation will just continue, not a problem, without missing a beat. And his head almost popped off and saying, this is about Russia. It's not whatever. He said, let's face it, Trump's going to pick some stooge who is just going to kill the investigation. I think while he can't do what you suggest, because the time has passed, it seems to me if on Thursday, before he leaves for Europe, leaves for Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Rome, and the Vatican, if he picks somebody who's credible to run the FBI, who even the Democrats are going to have to swear, let's say it's Andrew McCabe for the acting guy, or somebody who's got real credentials, a former judge who's not a nut, it seems to me that's another way. Not only is it good for America, but it also helps at least mute some of the crap, that blowback that's come from this thing. Do you not agree?
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a little bit of hysteria about this because from my vantage point, Comey did nothing but mess up this investigation, you know, from the... Well, I mean, just the length of the alleged conversation with the president was too long. At some point, if
you... mean the dinner thing?
Yeah.
Was he supposed to walk out on the president?
Absolutely.
Say, I gotta go?
Say, we can't have this conversation. Oh. And if the president persists, then you go.
Which is what Loretta Lynch sort of should have said to
yes.
Bill Clinton. We might not have.
Yes.
Wasn't the actual president of the United States.
That's a very good point. That's a good point.
Yes. But I want to make one point. Because I've actually been through FBI training for a bunch of things, including firearms. And I have enormous respect for the professionalism of the organization. And so I think that the investigation will go along fine without Comey. Matter of fact, I think Comey was baggage because he would grandstand and do unpredictable things. And it's a real surprise to me.
But if he picks Chris Christie as an example,
but
can
Gowdy.
Anybody believe that Chris Christie
is
going to do an independent
investigation?
Jim,
he can't pick Chris Christie because he knows or should know that Christie is not confirmable, particularly in
Fine.
This environment.
Okay. Yeah, but if he picks John Cornyn, I mean,
Senator from Texas.
Yeah, I frankly think all the folks right now on TV and on TV yesterday saying that he needs to pick an FBI professional, just like you laid out, or a judge who can pass muster, all those people are doing a disservice to all of those people because I frankly think they're going to push him into him saying, you know, I get to choose this. I'm going to decide who I want, and I might want John Cornyn or I might want Trey Gowdy or one of these folks, because I get to decide because I'm Donald Trump and I get to make this decision.
As a pragmatic, you see how long it's taken to confirm relatively uncontroversial people. For this job at this time, we have to be realistic and say, no matter who he nominates, that person is not going to get confirmed this year. Probably
what's the name, the name of the guy who's the senator?
No.
Who's the one who proposed Merrick Garland, the Republican senator proposed?
Oh, Lee.
Mike Lee?
I had actually speculated about that before.
How
Mike
brilliant
Lee.
Would
yeah,
that be
yeah. Well,
to
thank
pick
you,
the
that was
guy
my idea too.
who Barack Obama picked to be on the
it
Supreme
will never
Court?
Happen. Yeah. It's brilliant. But
it would
never
happen.
Yeah. It's mostly brilliant because it was Mike's idea. First.
Right. But he'd also have to give up a lifetime appointment on the
yes,
federal bench,
right,
which,
right.
you know, that would
which
be
which they could do and then fire him 6 months later, and then he's off the bench and out of the FBI. So
you know,
it's a brilliant move.
Before we end our trashing of Comey, we should remember, and for those who've forgotten, 60 Minutes did a great piece on it last night, reminding all the people that watch 60 Minutes, most of whom are older Americans who are the most reliable voters, that James Comey was one of the few people in the United States of America who was willing to lose his job over a matter of principle that involved George Bush and surveillance
Ashcroft.
Stuff after 9/11. And he and the went down to Ashcroft with his resignation ready to go. They eventually won. But, I mean, I'd like to see a few more people willing to put.
Wait, but before we leave that, I didn't watch 60 Minutes last night. I wasn't old enough. So did they address the issue, which I have still not heard adequately addressed, if it was appropriate for you to break with protocol and disclose publicly what you were doing on the Hillary Clinton front? Why was it not appropriate for you to disclose what you're doing with Russia?
It was not a new interview.
Oh, it was not. Oh,
no,
I'm sorry.
It was
okay.
A replay of the interview that when he was first appointed, that talked about this incident with George W. Bush. And I think many people are looking for some Republicans, Mike, to be a little bit more courageous, like maybe Paul Ryan, and not be backing up a president that seems to be doing things that are causing a lot of us to wonder.
Well, my sense is that you're going to be happy soon because I think there's growing feeling in the Republicans in Congress that there's got to be an independent investigation of one type
really
or another. Yeah, I do, actually.
Well, did you
yeah.
see that NBC poll? Yeah. 78% of American people, God yeah. love them, say they do not trust Congress. They want an independent investigation.
Well, that might have accelerated the thinking a little bit.
Might have accelerated the thinking,
that and the electoral calendar.
But, you know, on the flip side of this, Steve Kerrigan, there was a piece somewhere in the Hill or some, I don't know where it was this weekend, and it was not vicious, but it was saying one of the problems the Democrats have is there's no leading credible
the
voice
globe,
in the
Democrat.
Was
that
it the Globe? I'm
yes.
sorry.
It was Matt Pfizer.
Okay,
yes.
So my apologies to two. I really like both of them, by the way. I just forgot where I'd read it. That, I mean, they make a legitimate point. I mean, the little niches in the Democratic Party have leaders. But in terms of this, and I know it's hard when it's not a presidential year, but that does inhibit the Democrats, does it not?
It's Will Rogers had the greatest line about the Democratic Party. I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat. And that's truer now more than ever because we are a very divided party. And this is our time in the wake of a Trump election with everything that's going on to unite. But I frankly think the unification is going to be around the resistance in communities and in states, and you're seeing more and more people getting active. 11,000 women have signed up to run for office in 2017 and 2018 since the election. People are getting energized. People are out there working. They're not necessarily working through the party structure. I think I've said it here before. I never thought that Donald Trump would be the first post-partisan president, but mm-hmm. I think he actually is doing a very good job of exciting people who are not necessarily, particularly millennials, who don't feel like they're in a party system, but they really want to be active.
But can I say something? I'm not being disrespectful at all of the 11,000 people, because my attitude is always, if you have a real complaint about government beyond voting, which is your first obligation, run. Go do something.
As you did.
I did, unfortunately. And unfortunately, I won, which is even worse.
Impressive performance.
But not for
but
long.
But that tree is very thankful.
But you know, Mitt Romney did a really good thing for the Republican Party one year when he got 100 and some Republicans to run for state rep races. And my recollection is every single one of them lost. So the notion that sarcastically. Yeah. I meant good for him to actually encourage. But the fact that 11,000 women are going to these conferences and are ready to roll. You know,
well, I mean, for me, it means there was 11,000 people, some of whom never were engaged in sort of civic engagement at all. And now they're running for school committee or finance committee mm-hmm. or housing board in their town because they feel like they want to give something back. Okay. They don't know how they can fix Donald Trump, but they know they can try to make it.
So, Jim, I want to go back to my more comfortable role of disagreeing with you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So if you look at history, you look at Watergate, there was no big Democratic voice on the other side. I mean, the person that became the symbol was one of the more obscure members.
Peter Rodino?
No, I'm thinking of Sam Ervin.
Oh,
you know, from the and then Howard Baker.
Mm. Republican.
Republican, yeah. So I don't think that. I think that's the Democratic leader. I think at this
I didn't
point,
mean on just on the impeachment thing. I meant in general. There's not a go to. And by the way, maybe it's not so odd, not just because of your history lesson, but because it isn't the presidential year and they just lost the presidential election. So I'm not even criticizing them. I'm just observing, as did Linsky and Advisor.
It's actually a good thing in some ways for Democrats because it opens up the field with a lot of attention.
I couldn't disagree more. Yeah, when you have Nancy Pelosi, who we get angry email every time I say it because I'm a sexist dog and it has nothing to do with that. Been too long at the fair as far as I'm concerned. Hillary Clinton, same deal.
Yeah.
And even to a lesser degree, Barack Obama. They need an opening for the next phase
my point.
Of leadership.
That's exactly my point. And I think Senator Harris from California, Klobuchar from Minnesota, Cory Booker. I mean, those are the people that you should, they'll be looking at to say, do they have the right stuff to lead the party? And what better opportunity than something like this? And if it turns out that, the Bidens and the Clintons are still controlling the visuals, then I think it's going to be a problem for
Democrats. But it does seem to me, before you get to who's going to lead the party, you need to win in 2018. Well, I mean, because that's... There's a lot of things that are upsetting to certain people. I just today reading about all these things that we used to know about, from like animal welfare abuse to climate change stuff, has all been erased been blocked off from people getting public access to. I mean, the hiddenness and the climate stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on that I think many people want to have changed.
Yeah, and look, we're in a better spot, no doubt. Democrats are to win back seats in the House. Charlie Cook. Moved 20 or so seats.
It's a political report if you've never heard of me.
Republican seats to toss-ups or Democratic likely seats. Next year, we need to win 24, and he moved 20 over. There are 94 districts across the country where Democrats fared better in November than Ossoff fared in the first in Georgia. So there's a lot of opportunity out there. So, yes, our party leadership needs to be intact to give the resources and the field experience and the people on the ground. But I do think, frankly, our unelected leaders in folks like NARAL, where I'm on the board, we're fighting for women's rights, people at Planned Parenthood, people at Move On, people at the Resistance, like everybody out there fighting who aren't elected, I think are going to be really helpful in moving the ideals of the Democratic Party
forward. Well, they were fighting on November 8th, too, weren't they?
Yes, they were. But if you look where NARAL had people on the ground in Nevada and New Hampshire, we won
Nevada
both.
Nevada to you, my friend.
Okay.
Exactly. You know where
we won those Senate
seats? I learned that from Michelle Obama,
did
by
you
the really way.
Yes. But we won both those Senate seats, and we won an on-the-ground fight for those electoral votes.
But what about
votes?
The big tent theory? You know, I don't know if Thomas Green was right, but he wrote this in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago talking about how the Democrats are going to keep losing the Catholic vote if they're not more welcoming to those who are pro-life.
So there are folks, there are no doubt folks in the Democratic Party who are pro-life. And all the research will tell you 7 in 10 Americans support access to illegal abortion.
Right.
And a lot of those pro-life people believe that too. So they can personally be pro-life.
Like Cuomo and Ted Kennedy
people. But, yeah, exactly. But they don't think the government should be in the business, which is really what I think we're seeing trending in the data is that.
But look
there
at
are
the blowback Pelosi got from
I know, and
that.
I she's frankly, she has been saying that for years, and I frankly think she's been wrong for years.
You know, before we break, and then we're going to come back and talk about local things, a little bit later, we're going to talk to our listeners about whether or not it would be a horrible thing if Donald Trump followed through on his threat to end all press briefings, because you can't expect perfect accuracy. In light of the fact that almost every reporter now says on cable television, I don't trust anything that is said in that room. Would it be bad for democracy, Astro, and then Kerrigan, if those were ended and all we got were written statements and tweets?
I could imagine a president where that might not be the worst thing in the world. If you had a president like Bill Clinton, who truly was a master of detail and very forthcoming, it probably would be better for the press than what is often happening now. But I don't think this president is, to put it mildly, a master of the detail, so I think it would be a train wreck.
Without it.
Yeah.
I tend to agree with you. How about you, Steve?
I agree 100%. Okay. Look, the reporters in the room are the people's representatives to get information from this administration. Bad or good.
We're talking politics with Mike Astro and Steve Kerrigan. This conversation continues on 89.7. We're going to move locally. You're listening to WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm not laughing because, well, I am laughing, but we're going to keep it between ourselves. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're going over the latest local, now local, political headlines with Steve Kerrigan. He's the former CEO of the DNC, currently the president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund. Mike Astro is former commissioner for the Social Security Administration under the first under George W. Bush, my apologies, and Barack Obama.
So, Mike Astro, a lead story in the front page of the Boston Globe today, as you can see here. New talk of Massachusetts raising taxes. Do you think we're there yet for a whole bunch of reasons?
No, we shouldn't be there. And if, you know, there are some things that we should be talking about. And if we're serious about threatening the economy by raising taxes across the board, we should start with some of the stupid things that we're doing now. And the most stupid one is the movie tax, which is actually pays cash. It's not just a tax credit. And it's over $100 million a year.
Baker tried getting rid of that.
Well,
he
should.
For it.
And he should do it again. And Stan Rosenberg should wake up and do the right thing and stand up to the unions, because the unions are getting like about $1 million, $2 million of this. And they're the ones they're getting almost nothing. But it's still, there's a small benefit and yet they're sending this money out of state, and these credits are being sold on Wall Street.
We don't want to debate. I don't want to debate.
No, but I will just say quickly on that. So the hometown of the Kerrigan family, Clinton, Massachusetts, just was host to Mark Wahlberg and all that crew that did Daddy's Home 2. There was an old pub called the Old Timer, great family-owned restaurant that closed last year. They were able to use that for one of their scenes. They invested in restaurants in the area. They stayed in hotels.
How much the taxpayers are paying for every job?
No,
created $118,000 a year under that tax credit.
It had a huge boon for that small community that needed it.
No. Okay, can I just step back for a second?
And let me just say,
Charlie Baker,
other state in the union has gotten rid of this.
Okay,
there are about like eight of them.
Now,
we
Charlie
shouldn't
Baker,
necessarily follow
fine.
Those.
Charlie Baker is pledged as a campaigner, no new taxes. And he says he has the same position. But with all due respect, and I have great respect for the governor, I do, Airbnb tax is okay because it's just leveling the playing field. So that's not really a violation of the pledge. $2,000 per employee fee to an employer for everybody they don't cover with health insurance, that's not really a tax, it's a fee. And by the way, the Republicans are the ones used to say a tax by any name is still a tax. But It's really a sort of a vacant pledge at this point, is it not, Micah? Even if you think he's right on the merits, the notion of honor my pledge, how can you say you're honoring a pledge when you've agreed to one huge tax you've proposed, this employee thing, and the health care thing, and two, just because of the level playing field, it's expansion of a tax. That's a tax increase, isn't it, Airbnb?
Well, it's a little fuzzy around the edges.
No, but you agree with me and don't want to say it. So fuzzy around the edges.
The question is, what's closing a loophole? And so with
Airbnb.
Airbnb, thank you. I don't use them. You know, is it a loophole because people are renting rooms, people are renting rooms and not paying taxes, and other companies are? You know, I'm okay with that. I'm pretty big on the no new taxes pledge, but I'm not bothered by that because that's sort of leveling a playing field. I also have an exception for the public health. So it would not bother me if we went from having the lowest marijuana tax in the country to, you know, being second or third lowest, because quite frankly, I'm not sure that, you know, that's good for people in the state to make, you know, this be the most accessible state in the union for marijuana.
Okay.
Okay, what?
Is that it?
Well, yeah, we're
apparently
done.
It you know, is. I left them speechless.
Back to the Crawler debate?
we didn't mention this piece, which I thought was very interesting, because I thought the $2,000 I get small businesses don't like it, obviously. But when people are offering insurance that's so bad that people feel like they'll end up better on Medicaid, and MassHealth, rather, that's kind of what we got into pre-Obamacare, where the policies were so bad that people went bankrupt because when they got sick, their policies wouldn't cover them. So, you know, you don't want to dump on small businesses, but it does seem to me if you're going to offer insurance, you want to offer a decent policy to your employees. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm all for decent policies. I know, and the question is the best way to do it, and it's extremely complicated. And there is sort of a tradition in this area. I mean,
did you know it was complicated before President Trump said it was complicated?
I used to say when I was general counsel at HHS, there are only 12 people in the country who understand Medicaid. Thank goodness six of them work for me. But, you know, there is a tradition in healthcare of things that I personally think are taxes and not calling them taxes. And the Obama administration did it too. We're seeing a little bit of that with the Baker administration, although I also think this was more of a warning shot than a serious proposal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't certainly go very far, but it did sort of create an impact on the people he was trying to talk to. So, I mean, again, a little fuzzy on the edges, but I think that Charlie is still there. I mean, if you're concerned about another round of high taxes driving jobs out of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker is still the guy you got to rally behind.
Yeah, and I should point out, I mentioned Commonwealth Magazine because they did a piece sort of disputing some of Baker's findings.
No,
saying,
they didn't do a piece. The anti-tax Mass Taxpayers Foundation did the piece on behalf of employers who don't want to pay the fee. So,
okay, well, it ran.
It's in Commonwealth.
Magazine. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mention the anti-tax parties. Were you associated with them?
I mean, they're very decent people, but they represent the businesses who oppose the fee that Baker proposed. So it's not surprising that
it didn't have some of the key. In order to decide what's really happening, it didn't look at some of the data that would be key to really.
But my point, if I just may, before Steve, you have the final word today. My point was not whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. My point was not that the Airbnb is a good idea or a bad idea. My point was, when you're head of Harvard Pilgrim, and one of the reasons you succeeded and became governor is because you raised premiums, which to me is a variation on a tax.
No.
When you run and say, I'm not going to raise taxes, but Airbnb is an exception, the $2,000 fee is an exception, it's sort of, it's not, it's not, it's not,
He's helping
genuine,
millionaires.
I think.
Mean, we should be used to it. Mitt Romney did. He's also did no new taxes and
$750 million in fees.
Fees and fines.
And that's what the Republican Party has done for Massachusetts time and again. Democrats want to engage in a discussion about what is the Commonwealth we would like to have and how much, frankly, is it going to cost to have it, to provide good schools, to provide health care, to make sure our streets are safe, we have a clean environment and a better economy. We have that conversation. We understand there's an increased cost. We're honest about it. They try to sneak
well,
it
in. Well, see, Mike Esther doesn't have the courage to have that debate because all he wants to do is have the crawler debate, which we had off the air. It's pretty obvious.
It's an all-winner debate on
the crawler. Don't you think the millionaire's tax will bail the governor out, perhaps?
Excuse me.
No.
Excuse me. Who was the first person? Here's my thesis that Marjorie attempted to steal.
Okay.
That Charlie Baker is going to do the following. Charlie Baker is going to do what Bill Weld did in 1990. I ran an effort to kill
those were the glory years.
A big tax cut. And Weld, one of the reasons Bill Weld, who I admire, was very successful is he had the best of both worlds. He supported a huge tax cut, and thanks to me and the people I work with, it lost. So the beauty is he got another $1 billion a year to spend. In my estimation, what Charlie Baker is hoping for, he'll oppose modestly the millionaire's tax. It will pass, and he'll get $2 billion to spend opposed.
No, Charlie's way too smart because he knows the experience recently in Connecticut and Maryland where left-wing governors imposed a millionaire's tax, and immediately their economies went into the toilet, that the number of high-income people filing in Maryland dropped dramatically. They moved out of state. And the whole reason we have General Electric, our pride now, in a local
it's because them old wants to be downtown rather than in the
woods. No, it's because the millionaire's tax in Connecticut was the straw that broke the camel's back and drove them out of Connecticut.
It's great to see you both.
They're running out of places to go, though. That's my hope. Steve Kerrigan is former CEO of the DNC. He's currently the president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund. Mike Astor, who brought us those wonderful donuts. Again, where's the donut place? Linda's Donuts in Belmont. Those were excellent crullers, if I do say so myself, Mike. He's former commissioner of the Social Security Administration, working in both the Bush and Obama administrations, and he also writes poetry under the pseudonym A.M. Juster. Thank you both for coming in. Coming up, we're opening up the lines and asking you, should the White House do away with daily press briefings if the information coming out of the press secretary often contradicts the president or is not true? In other words, what will we do without Sean Spicer? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And over the weekend on Fox News with Judge Jeanine Pirro, President Trump threatened once again to cancel the White House daily press briefings.
Are you moving so quickly that your communications department cannot keep up with
you? Yes, that's true.
So what do we do about that?
We don't have press conferences, and we do...
You don't mean that.
Well, we just don't have them. Unless I have them every 2 weeks and I do myself. We don't have them. I think it's a good idea.
So as an alternative to having the likes of Glenn Thrush or Jonathan Carl or April Ryan holding the government accountable during these daily press briefings, President Trump suggests something, I guess, a little less dynamic.
Would you seriously consider stopping these press sessions?
No, we do it in a different way.
How?
We do it through a piece of paper with a perfectly accurate, beautiful answer.
The threat most likely, obviously, is in response to the fact the White House communications team directly contradicted the president as to why he fired James Comey. Accuracy, of course, has not been a mainstay of these daily dealings with the press. Sean Spicer's first foray into the James Brady press briefing room, as it's called, may have established the precedent.
We do know a few things, so let's go through the facts. We know that from the platform where the president was sworn into 4th Street holds about 250,000 people. From 4th Street to the media tent is about another 220,000. And from the media tent to the Washington Monument, another 250,000 people. All of this space was full when the president took the oath of office. We know that 420,000 people used the D.C. Metro public transit yesterday, which actually compares to 317,000 that used it for President Obama's last inaugural. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
Boy, those were the good old days. We're opening up the lines asking you if these briefings should be canceled. 877 301-8970. If we aren't getting accurate information from the White House, remember Chuck Todd said to us almost a month ago that he didn't believe what was said at those briefings. If these briefings could be used to mislead the press and the public, are we better off with Trump's daily piece of paper with a, quote, perfectly accurate, beautiful answer? Would it free up a huge amount of White House correspondents to investigate the White House instead of making sense of these press briefings? 877-301-8970. Can I just say,
yes,
the fact that someone on television, Jeanine Pirro, could ask Donald Trump, are you moving so quickly that your communications department can't keep up with you? Now, I am not Tim Russert, so don't send me emails saying this is typical Jim arrogance. I literally get hives thinking about what if I ever asked a question like that intentionally. Sometimes I ask pathetically weak questions, but I don't mean to. I just screw up. Can you imagine having that question on your list and
I keep telling
asking
you, Jim,
are you so what?
Watch the evening lineup.
Watch
Sean Hannity practically fawning over everything the president
does. So do you think they should? Mike Estes, who's a pretty conservative Republican, thinks they should not cancel the briefings. A pretty liberal Democrat, Steve Kerrigan, felt the same way. I'm with both of them. Relying upon tweets and written statements that I was going to say you can't cross-examine, but that's what it's come down to, that you can't ask questions of, even if the answers are not truthful, it gives the American public, either on radio or television at night, an opportunity to see what the president and his people are saying. I think they're invaluable, even though they're not to be relied upon.
Well, they're wonderfully entertaining. And I think that we know
it's not what I meant,
the reason why they will continue, because later on in that interview, we have the clip of this, later on in that interview, when President Trump is talking with Fox News' Judge Jeanine Pirro, he talks about the amazing ratings the White House press briefings yield. Here it is.
Conferences weren't even covered for Obama, practically. They were on C-SPAN and C-SPAN 2, and, you know, there was nothing going on.
But will you put an end
to
them?
Just let me, these press conferences are like the biggest thing on daytime television.
They are.
Okay? You see the ratings.
Yes.
They're blowing away everything on, just about, I think, everything on daytime television.
He goes on to say he just doesn't know what the television stations are going to do without the Trump daily briefings. So, I mean, there's some talk about a big staff shakeup, that Sean Spicer is history, that Steve Bannon is history, that Reince Priebus, he's on the edge, but he may survive. Even his lawyer is maybe out the door.
Oh,
soon.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
the person that Sally Yates met with.
Right, he's supposedly one of the people that's in trouble, but who knows if this is actually going to happen. But I think because of these amazing ratings. And it is true, Jim. I mean, when Sean Spicer comes on every day, I can hardly
pay attention. We can hardly talk. It's usually the end of our show.
Because I'm glued to the Chiron.
She's serious, by the way.
And,
she's not
and
joking.
And what he's saying next, because you just never know. And, of course, in the middle of the press conference, he morphs into Melissa McCarthy, and I wait for his podium to start to drive around the room and run over the reporters.
877-301-8970. But on a serious note, I think it'd be a disaster if these things were canceled. Because even if they're not telling the truth or if they're uninformed, then I think, with all due respect to Spicer, everybody knows Spicer. You remember when he got the job. Republicans and Democrats spoke glowingly of him as a person.
His life has been ruined.
Some of the time, obviously, on the crowd size, he knew he was cooking the books. But I assume a lot of the times, like, for example, when he was on vacation serving the military. But what was the name of the woman?
Huckabee Sanders.
Huckabee Sanders, Sarah. When she and the vice president and Kellyanne Conway were all saying that it was all about, on the recommendation of the assistant attorney general, that the firing happened when that was not what Donald Trump told Lester Holt. I don't think they were intentionally misleading the public.
No.
I think Donald Trump just took it in another direction. Having said that, it is really important that his voices, even if they're inaccurate, I think be available to the public.
I
so I feel really strongly about
when the history books are written, if not sooner, we will find out that the assistant, the deputy attorney general Rosenstein said, you think you're hanging this on me?
That's what we've read already.
Yeah.
And that is why many people believe Donald Trump changed the story for Lester Holt, because he said, you're misrepresenting. I did a memo in response to my Monday meeting with you, not unilaterally. And I think he felt like that he was being seen as the hangman for Comey.
She gets up there and says,
who?
Huckabee Sanders. When the deputy attorney general gives such a blistering recommendation as that, what choice do you have?
877-301-8970. I have to say, well, one would think that almost anybody would consider it an honor to work for the president. If you are so embarrassed by your boss, whether he or she is president or head of a newsroom, or I mean, how do you go to work the next day? I mean, you're despite your toeing the line and saying, pretending like nothing happened, it's humiliating.
Well, you know, you think at some point, a lot of people. I mean, again, I've mentioned Paul Ryan before to these guys, who used to be sort of the rising star, and he was the darling of the Republicans, and he was.
Did you see Saturday Night Live when he's got Paul Ryan as the little ice cream boy getting ice cream for the president?
I think he looks like kind of a fool.
I agree.
And Spicer looks like kind of a fool, and frankly, even Mitch McConnell is beginning to look kind of like a fool. So I'm not nearly as hysterical as I was before, because I think it's just become so crazy. That it's a matter of time, Jim.
Tim from Worcester, you're first. Thanks so much for calling in. We welcome you. Hi.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate the show.
Thanks.
I really think that they should continue this craziness of Sean Spicer. It's just fantastic. I already have an SNL skit ready to go. And it basically features Rob Gronkowski from the New England Patriots coming in the middle of a Sean Spicer press release.
Right, that could never happen.
Never happen.
Wouldn't that be fantastic? Well, the thing is, remember when he already came in?
I was joking. It did happen. Yeah, we know that. Yeah, Tim, thank you for the call. When you have the skit written, email it to us, and we'll maybe decide if it's airworthy. 877-301-8897. You know that Spicer is a big fan of the Patriots and has mentioned the Patriots more than one time in a press conference.
Well, he's from Rhode Island.
And when the Patriots, or at least half the Patriots, went to the White House to meet with the president, the Gronkowski did enter the press room.
You know, can you imagine if you were Sean Spicer and all week long you saw these previews of Saturday Night Live
with her riding on the podium around the city,
riding around Manhattan on the podium, looking angry and ticked off and screaming.
Well, I would assume the first time you'd be honored, wouldn't you think? You'd say, "Oh my God!" Even if they're making fun of me,
I'm on SNL.
But they really—if you watch this Saturday, which wasn't that funny, we're going to talk to Bob Thompson. I didn't think it was that funny with Bob Thompson. And later, they really they treat them like morons. It's not just ridicule and satire. They really are treating the White House people, I think, in some cases unfairly, like they're all idiots. Shane, you're in New Hampshire. You're on with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Welcome.
Hi, guys. I think that this is just another step in a very scary direction, trying to get rid of these press conferences. We need the press to hold the president accountable. And despite the last one not being that funny, what would SNL do anymore? Seriously.
What do you mean?
I just mean they got plenty of great material from.
Oh, they do, but it's hard to parody, as I'm going to say a little bit later in the show. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I don't think it's so funny, because when you watch Spicer himself in the afternoon, it's comical how it's like a pretzel. It's just. It's unbelievable. Shane, thank you for the – I think it would be – to reiterate what I said and you said and the callers said, it would be a disaster. It would be horrible if you don't have – you know, it's sort of like people often ask me when I do a thing. I've said this on the air too. Who's the greatest interviewer ever? I think it was Tim Russert. And one of his greatest skills was he knew when to stop. Even if you asked the question repeatedly, well, why don't you keep asking it, Jim or Marjorie or whatever, till you get an answer? Because you know the moment, if you're really good like he was, when the failure to answer – is the answer. And I think most of these reporters, with some exceptions in that press briefing room, have done a really good job of exposing to the American people what's true and what's illusion, to be kind, you know?
You could always have the Russian reporters.
From TASS.
And then we could watch the Russians play our press briefings all around the world, and we can learn about it secondhand, like we learned about their friendly relations in the White House last week when the American press was blocked and the Russian press was let in. Linda in the car. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Linda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've never called your show before. I absolutely love it. And Emma Price is a personal friend of mine, but I think our country is in a crisis right now, which is why I'm calling. There's three things: gerrymandering, the ease with which voting machines, electronic, can be manipulated, and cross-check. I would love for you to do a show on cross-check. I think
what is it?
It's a means through which they purge voting rolls several streets because the same name, like my name, Linda Brown, would be on the rolls in different states. So those states purged every name that has the same person or what they said was the same person. I think all the time. talk about voter fraud and the study of it right now is to purge voting rolls. The Republicans control the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court, 33 governorships. For any Democrat to win anything going forward, cross-check has to be addressed.
Well, can I tell you something? Linda, you're going to be heartened if you haven't heard this already, that a to quote from the first paragraph of a New York Times story about an hour ago, a lower court ruling that struck down key parts of the North Carolina voter ID law that some people thought limited, targeted specifically African Americans, the Supreme Court won't reinstate it. They refused to reinstate it. They upheld the lower court's decision, which is a move on a conservative Supreme Court in the direction that you were hoping they'd go. So there's some, I guess, sunlight today into a very dark area.
I'm equally worried about in the 2018 race and the 2020 race about this continued Russian influence. I mean, we just saw it in France. It's not clear to me that we've done anything about this. And the same teenagers that were writing all these crazy stories in 2016 about Hillary Clinton and her 39,000 guillotines could be writing them against the Democrats, assuming they want the Republicans to win in 2018.
Linda, thanks for your first call, and we'll follow up on your suggestion. Hope you call again soon. You know, one heartening thing on this Russian influence thing, I think
what?
It was over the weekend,
what?
That Tillerson was the most unequivocal,
he was,
as he's been, Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, that he's been about Russian influence and the fear of it going forward, at the same time that Donald Trump is probably the only person in America who continues to dance around the issue.
That's how crazy the situation has gone. It's gotten. You look at Rex Tillerson, and he was on the talk shows yesterday, and you think, God, you breathe a sigh of relief. He may not be your favorite guy. You may not really Exxon, but he's not crazy, and he sounds normal. And then you look at the president with Lester Holtz and Jean Pirro, and you just think, what is going on? I mean, it's almost impossible not to wonder.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, you know what I did this weekend?
What?
I actually watched the Lester Holt interview a second time.
It is incredible.
Two observations. One that I had said before, Holt really did a good job and
he
didn't
did a
take
great
any
job.
Any crap or
he was criticized
for interrupting too much.
Since I'm spending all my time now watching conservative media and reading about it, he was criticized over and over the place for interrupting
him
too many times.
He interrupted him a lot, but he wanted to keep him on course. But you really get the sense, and that part I think is hard to differ with. You do get the sense that Donald Trump sort of makes it up as he goes. I don't think he went in there with a, you know, he may have gone in with an agenda to say it wasn't, you know, the Hillary Clinton thing it wasn't the Assistant Attorney General memo. And that probably was because the Assistant Attorney General was so upset and communicated with the White House saying, you're setting me up.
Right.
The president's got to take responsibility for this. But so much else that was said in this interview as he's leaning forward. Talking to Holt, you get the sense it's sort of like, okay, let me see how this flies. No, I'm serious. I don't even know if I mean it disrespectfully. I mean it observationally. That's really the impression you get when you watch this thing closely.
Yeah, keep trying. Maybe something will
stick. Exactly. I should have said that. That's
just
much
throw
better.
It out there and see how that goes. They threw out the firing of Comey. It didn't work like they expected. All these Democrats weren't ecstatic about it. Whoops. Okay, well, we'll rejigger and go back at another front.
So I'm sorry we're digressing. What we're talking about is the suggestion that Donald Trump made both in a tweet last week and then with Judge Jeanine Pirro on Fox News that he may just can these live press conferences because it's hard to be, quote, perfectly accurate when she says you're moving so fast.
Have we mentioned Sean Spicer in the bushes yet?
Oh, and Saturday Night Live? That was pretty funny,
just
too.
In general, he's out in the hedges. And then somebody flashed that great shot of Jesse Jackson saying, keep out of the bushes.
Keep out
the bushes.
Andy, you're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call, Andy. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I think steps like this of limiting access to news and to media, these kinds of steps are taken by dictators, not by presidents of the United States.
Yeah. Well, you're not the first person to make that comparison, Andy. That's for sure.
Yeah, so I know I'm reiterating, but
no, it's fine.
It's a dangerous and slippery slope.
You know, I don't have any evidence to base this on. I think that was a trolling behavior by Donald Trump. I don't think he has any intention of dumping these press conferences, sadly, for the reason that you mentioned, because the ratings are so good.
The ratings. It's all about ratings
and
numbers and who's got the biggest crowd on the Esplanade or whatever they call the thing, the Washington. What do they call that thing?
I'm not telling
whatever
you.
Whatever it is.
The mall.
The mall. Thank you very much. The Washington Mall and who got...
Can you repeat what you said? Can you repeat what you said before?
About the little maps that he
gives
out
of
the
White
House?
Yeah, that was in a story this weekend. I wasn't aware of that. He does most of his work in a little anteroom, a little dining room off the Oval Office.
This will be the first time, this trip, it's going to be the first time that he has not slept either in the White House or Mar-a-Lago since he came into office. He's kind of...
Not in New Jersey? He hasn't slept in Jersey?
I don't think so.
Okay, so explain what these little maps he hands out are.
Well, they're electoral win maps. Mm-hmm. He has apparently
color coded,
blowout thing, color coded, and he gives them out to people. And he talks a lot about it when they come to visit him at the White House. I mean, you know, it is. My gosh, I wish I lived.
But you know,
I wish I lived 100 more years so I could read the history books of this period in American history.
Step back from a second.
Assuming we're still here.
You know, I think I don't know if I said this to somebody off the air this weekend, or we said it Friday when we were doing our show from the library. You know, the conventional wisdom from most people with whom I speak, uh-huh, we speak, is that the reason that he is so troubled by this Russia investigation by Comey, formerly by Comey, was because the walls were closing. That may be true. It also may be true, and I buy this to a significant degree, that any proof of Russian impact, not just
exactly,
on the election, underlines the thing that freaks him out most is the delegitimization,
Jim,
of his election on November 8th. And that apparently is what he's obsessed with.
I just told you, he's handing out all these maps.
Yeah.
What will it mean for the maps if he finds out that the Russians really determined this election? It would have been won by
Hillary
Clinton.
Did you hear that some of the, he had asked for some of the maps back, they were in Russian. I don't know if you're aware of this. That some of the color-coded maps were, it said, Does Vidania or something on there.
Okay, we have time for one more
Bonnie,
call.
You'll have 30 seconds.
Yeah,
you're Marlboro,
because
Marjorie talked
too
much.
Sorry.
Hi, Bonnie. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say it's a great idea. He's just a placeholder right now, as far as I'm concerned.
The president?
I think your journalism and your whole section of us being 50 states and each state on its own, we are managing ourselves as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Without that whole bunch, narrow it down to maybe 10, I don't know, administrations in the Washington, and let each state do their own.
Well, we need, Bonnie, you know, we need a lot of money from the federal government, and not just we. Secondly, there are a lot of rules that you actually want to establish. You want uniformity amongst the states. But I understand you're being somewhat dubious about what's going on there. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. Coming up, we're going to talk with Charlie Sennett. Russia's among the many nations that have been hit hard by a cyber attack, and they aren't happy about it. Could this stop them from hacking the rest of us? Charlie Sennett joins for that and more on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, today at noon on Boston Public Radio, we'll be joined by Ground Truth's Charlie Sennett. As ransomware runs wild, North Korea launches again, and the president prepares for his first overseas trip.
Homeboy, novel-writing superstar Dennis Lehane on his latest Boston-based book, a page-turner about a Boston Globe reporter turned TV star. As we approach the 100th anniversary of JFK's birth, his nephew and historian Doug Brinkley, with amazing tales complete with hundreds of photographs of his political life. Then we open the lines and ask you, some coffee cafes are actually ditching Wi-Fi in favor of face-to-face customer chat. Really? Who wants that? Then our TV man, Bob Thompson, on Saturday Night Live, they've got great material, but are they turning it into great comedy? Plus, I can hardly wait, the return of American Idol. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, hour number two. Hello again, Jim Browdy.
I'm going to give a weather report.
Give a weather report.
The times, they are changing.
They are
starting
changing.
Tomorrow.
It's
thank 90 God.
Degrees on Thursday.
Okay, fine. Enough of that. So with a global cyber attack wreaking havoc on tens of thousands of computers across the world, North Korea successfully launching a new mid- to long-range missile, should President Trump be more worried about that 400-pound hacker sitting on his bed, Kim Jong-un, or if he'll get two scoops of ice cream when he leaves the comforts of the White House kitchen to embark on what will be his first foreign trip as president come Friday? Joining us in Studio 3 for his take on these and other international headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie is a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie Sennett, nice to see you.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hello, Charlie Sennett. So with all the excitement of the last few weeks, we've kind of been off the mark on North Korea. But
not
now,
you.
But now we're back. They've launched this missile. It made it 430 miles before landing in the ocean between Japan and North Korea. So what are we to think of this?
Well, this is the problem from hell, because there's no real solution that we have that we can just say, here's what you need to do. This is the way we're going to put more leverage on North Korea. This is a really tough one, right? So these are intermediate range ballistic missiles. The question is, how close are they getting to these intercontinental ballistic missiles? And what is that process look like in terms of a timeline? A lot of different answers on that. But one thing that's clear, they're getting closer and closer, and they're very persistent in these attempts. A couple things going on in the region that are huge. China is hosting a regional gathering of heads of state and putting forward an enormous proposal. They want to focus on soft power, on the beneficence of China in the world, in Africa and throughout Asia. And they were putting on the table a really interesting proposal for a new Silk Road, to build literally a highway that will connect Asia and go through Burma and go through all of these countries where there's ancient trading routes but not viable traffic, and try to open things up.
Oh, that's neat.
Beautiful vision. And then they have this annoying, you know, infantile despot who keeps testing missiles right when they're trying to focus on the world. And one of the pieces of the puzzle here, China has to put more pressure on North Korea. Question, how do we get them to do it?
Well, why, you know, I don't understand why they don't do it. Why don't they put the screws to North Korea? What's the downside for them? I haven't understood that. Just because the West wants them to? Is that what the issue is, or what is it?
You know, it's a really good question. There was a guy, I was in Washington all last week. Interesting time to be in Washington, by the way. But one of the guys we met with was an expert on North Korea from Brookings. We asked him that question exactly, and he basically said, it is so hard to figure out what is China's intention. What do they want from North Korea, and how can they control it? And I think one of the consensus points, I wouldn't call it like backed up with a lot of facts or anything I could really grab onto, but was this impression that this is very much a regional problem. That North Korea is a threat to the region. The newly elected president of South Korea wants engagement and diplomacy. That may be indeed what China wants as well, but they know that contravenes some of the thinking in Washington around, is that a good idea? So I think this is unsettled, to put it mildly. I don't know where it's going to go. I think that still much more leverage needs to be put on China to do more with the sanctions. But look, we've been doing that sanctions routine for a long time, and it's not working. So,
well, you know, it makes me really nervous. I don't want to make Marjorie do something for the next few minutes. You don't get more anxious. You're mentioning the new president of South Korea, who says, yeah, we keep our door open for dialogue with North Korea, but we must act decisively against North Korean provocations so that they won't miscalculate. And the United States, in a statement, White House says, a flagrant menace for far too long. I get nervous. That I don't know what South Korea is going to do. I don't know enough about it. Mm-hmm. But I get nervous when it seems to me that the statements, the response of the White House get fiercer and fiercer, that at some point they're going to feel like their manhood has been challenged,
especially,
and we're going to do something here.
Especially when the president's ratings are lower and lower and lower.
Exactly.
And the one time he's gotten a bump is when he fired the missiles at Syria. And
it's a very good
and
point.
Unfortunately, people seem to love military action, even when it can get us into a huge mess.
This is the danger of the moment we live in right now, with a White House in turmoil and with a really complicated world that wants clarity from the United States of America, and they're not hearing it. So, do you guys know Jennifer Griffin? She's
no.
the security correspondent for Fox News. She's a great reporter, an incredible reporter, and, you know, really a straight shooter. I really admire her work. She had an amazing point about the peril of the moment with a president who has this hair trigger finger for Twitter, that literally words matter. And she was expressing, you know, just to collegially, just to a few colleagues, this really smart basis of her reporting, which is we have to be really precise with words. And she is in her reporting. But I also think one of the things that we were talking about just informally was, hey, what happens when words get too far ahead of plausible actions or rational actions? And that can trigger something, and we have to think about that. And I think there's a need for the media right now to be the measured response, the step-down analysis of what's really happening. And when we hear these kinds of statements and bellicose statements, to be sure we evaluate them as journalists really carefully and realize we live in a world where information travels at lightning speed. And we'd really want to tread lightly in that part of the world right now.
Okay, well.
Sorry to bum you out, Marjorie.
Here's Marjorie. No, okay, I mean, because, on to ransomware.
Because it does seem.
Yeah, onto something that can settle our nerves.
Yeah, it's, with what we know now, the likelihood of some sort of bellicose action out of the White House seems almost the only way to change the subject.
Well, he's been restrained so far, and he has, here's the upside, and he also thinks he has a really good relationship with President Xi.
Yeah.
And if President Xi is seen as the linchpin of whatever the ultimate real solution is, maybe he wants to broker a diplomatic thing and claim credit for Xi's involvement.
That would be wonderful. Anyway, let's move on to the cheerful subject of ransomware, affecting almost 200,000 people around the world. The hospitals that we read about over the weekend in England, FedEx, a train system in Germany, and this is a huge problem. How vulnerable are we? Are we in the same boat as all the rest of these people?
Got to be honest, this one's out of my depth, but yeah. I'll tell you what I've been hearing, just the reporting you're hearing, if you're following this in international news realms, is that the United States is in slightly better shape than the rest of the world. Why? Because the United States is tougher on piracy. It's pirated software that's the most vulnerable. So,
right.
if you own an operating system, or you're working with an operating system that isn't either up to date for viruses or that is pirated, you're much more vulnerable. That opens up cracks and seams through which this malware can penetrate. And there is a greater likelihood of that happening in the world than there is in America. That doesn't mean we're not in for a bad Monday morning, especially if you're the IT guy and you're looking at this mess. So that's about the extent of what I know. I don't want to go further than that because I would be out over my skis, as they say.
Well, I did think one thing that was encouraging, apparently, despite these tens of thousands, you know, as I said before, 200,000 people around the world having some impact here, that they've only got $26,000 in payment. Because they were saying
the $300 in Bitcoin.
So,
by the way, that 200,000 figure is misleading. I've read that a lot, too. When you essentially shut down a huge part of the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, you're affecting, maybe not directly, but indirectly, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. But sorry.
The scary thing is the British, the Spanish, other healthcare agencies that are canceling surgeries, shutting down, literally effectively shutting down operating rooms inside hospitals. This is serious business. I don't think it's going to be a very pleasant Monday morning, but I think we'll know a lot more by the time the smoke clears a bit.
You know, Charlie,
this week.
I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about the president's first foreign trip on Friday. But before we get there, you just mentioned a minute ago you were in Washington. I assume during the Comey firing and I'm assuming hanging around with people like you, international reporters. What was the reaction to two things? One, the Comey firing, and two, the rather incredible day after with TASS getting access to the Oval Office.
Oh, my God.
During this meeting with leading Russian diplomats and American media being barred from the Oval Office.
It really was an amazing few days to be in Washington, where you could feel the barometric pressure just dropping on this administration, in a sense that this is history in the making. This is potentially, we're not there yet, we'll see where it goes, but that there's a feeling, certainly a tremor of constitutional crisis, you know, that what is going to happen here? Where are we going to go? Did the president, in his interview with Lester Holt, on the record illustrate, you know, obstruction of justice. And these questions burning through Washington were really interesting. And our prism on this was as the International Press Institute, gathering of foreign editors from different news organizations that cover the world and from around the world, getting together mostly the North American chapter of this organization. I'm on the board. It's sort of how we get together once a year from all over the world. We have our North America chapter, and the discussion really was about how this resonates in the world and a feeling that the places where a lot of these foreign editors are paying attention to or have worked as foreign correspondents, they know this kind of dysfunction. They know what it's like when a presidency starts to have favors done for business associates, family members, when they start to play fast and loose with the Constitution and the law. That's the third world. That's the developing world where tin pot dictators get away with this stuff. This is the United States of America. This is the place with that unbelievably strong constitution. And there's a sense out in the world, and the headlines in the international media reflect this, like, what is going on inside the United States? And where are those wonderful institutions?
There go those wild and crazy Americans.
That the rest of the world looks up to. And we can't forget that. That is like this burden on this country to be sure we allow the Constitution to guide us, that we have checks and balances. And I got to say, as a gathering of international media, one of the things we were really talking about is one of those checks and balances, the media, is under direct attack, right? The President of the United States has called the media the enemy of the people. We were shut out of a press conference and told you're not allowed to enter. Well, you had Foreign Minister
You mean the Oval Office thing, yeah.
The Oval Office briefing. So we were there with people who covered that, who went to go and were told you're not allowed in. And then the images are coming out in real time while we're gathered of, wait a second, look at this. It actually looks like TASS, the Russian government news agency, mm-hmm. is inside meeting with the president. And the images come out of them with their arms around each other, smiling. The day after Comey is fired, while he's investigating Russian influence, potentially,
you know, don't
into this
Henry
election.
Kissinger, the by only the way, the same
and
day.
Then Kissinger gets wheeled in. It's the ghosts of Watergate. And writ large. Now, I don't know.
But you know what? The only thing was missing because Trump does not drink. They didn't have a big bottle of vodka, you know, passing it around the room and toasting in the little glasses because he.
So, I'm sure you all watched the Sunday shows this weekend were particularly riveting, I thought.
But no Trump representatives, by the way.
Wasn't that amazing? Did you watch Fox News when
no.
they came on? The first thing they said on Sunday morning, Wallace said, I want to tell you what we don't have on the show
today.
Good
for him. That's
and he
great.
Said, we will not have the representatives of Washington. But one of the things I heard was Carl Bernstein.
Yeah, he was great.
This was an amazing interview on CNN where he laid out sort of what was Watergate, how long did it take, which was many, many months. We forget mm-hmm. that. It took a long time. And he said, this is a more serious moment. This is a bigger moment.
It's the Russians. Of course it is.
It's an adversary who has tampered with our democracy and a presidency that has taken steps that it's hard not to see when you just put the facts together as trying to thwart an investigation into it. And I don't care where you come from politically, if you're the left or you're the right, that's deeply meaningful. And if the media gets painted as the opposition, we're really in trouble because the media's job should be to dig and dig and dig. And that's not partisan. That's our job.
You know what I thought was a great moment? We can ask Chuck Todd in person when we see him on Thursday, though. At the beginning of his show, he does this whole montage of all the disasters of the week and then introduces his first guest, who is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. And Graham, I have to say, is pretty funny. Right after the montage ends, he says, why did I agree to do this?
But, you know, Graham and Trump, who had a very rough go during the campaign season, apparently are – I mean, Graham's been defending Trump on a lot of fronts, even though he didn't do much of that
I did not
this
think
weekend.
He was doing much of that
so
this
can
weekend.
So can we move to Friday? Friday, the president leaves, I think, for Israel, the Vatican – and Saudi Arabia. We know the Pope says, I'm going to give him a chance or some such mm-hmm. thing, or I don't know what he says. But
he's not going to attack him.
What's the purpose of this thing?
Good question. I mean, I think some of it is that the president wants to get out on a foreign trip. I mean, clearly they've they've clearly set the GPS for this as the Abrahamic Trail, mm-hmm. right? So this is going to be, we will go to Rome where we will see the Pope, and there's Catholicism and Christianity in its most global manifestation. We will go to Saudi Arabia, yeah. and there is Islam, where we will go and we will embrace, you know, the land of the two holiest shrines
Muslims.
Of Islam. And then we will go to Israel in our final bit of the tour for Judaism, and we will recognize our oldest brother in this Abrahamic faith.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're thinking, because this is a president who, watching him at Liberty University over the weekend, giving the commencement address, I just don't get how any religious person is going to buy that Donald Trump, given his story, given his personality, given who he is with the epic divorces, with the undercutting of business, that this is someone who really has thought much about faith and about religion
but
in
you know
his
what?
Life. Now, I might be wrong.
Well, he's the President of the United States. I think that may overcome
I might be wrong about this, too. But, you know, I think the Pope could really freak him out.
What, on the moral front?
Because he's old. He's overweight. The Pope is very charismatic.
Being old and overweight
you know,
have to do with anything.
He's going to be dead soon.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I'll hold it. So I think one of the biggest fake news stories of the entire campaign was
the Pope endorsed him. That's right, I forgot.
Trump.
Right.
When actually, the Pope's statements about Trump were about how you can't be Christian if you work against immigrants, because it is our job on this planet as Catholics, as the Pope would share, and Christians, he would add, to take people in, to protect the most vulnerable among us. That is the core message of the faith.
Yeah.
And Trump, remember, reacted right up against that and said this very, like, I forget,
he
had some tweet
yeah.
where he criticized the Pope for taking a political stand. And then the fake news article, which is literally one of the most trafficked yeah. articles of the election, makes up that the Pope endorses Trump. Now, who knows what they're going to make up next in this land of trolling and of people out there trying to manipulate information. But this is definitely being cast as a religious journey through the world and at a time when religious extremism is very much a part of the natural forces that are moving politics these days around
the world. Is he meeting with the boss, by the way, when he's in Israel? Is he meeting with the Palestinian leader, or is he not?
Well, I know that he's had that meeting with the boss.
Well, I know he has,
so
but I'm
going
talking about
to,
there.
I believe so. I think it would be very awkward if you don't go see a boss, because then you're only seeing one side. You could really ignite things. The biggest question on the table to look for in the next couple of days will be, is Jerusalem going to be named as the official capital, the recognized capital of Israel by the United States? That a lot of listeners are probably like, huh? Of course Jerusalem's the capital. It's the eternal, indivisible capital of the Jewish people. But the United States embassy is in Tel Aviv. Mm. And that's because Jerusalem has always been seen as an issue for final status negotiations,
right.
that it is a place near and dear to the hearts of three faiths, which he'll be visiting with. All three faiths are connected to that city. And it is a shared sacred space. So how do you recognize that in the Israeli-Palestinian final status talks, as they call them, is why it's never been fully put down by the United States as the capital exclusively of the Jewish people and of Israel. That's a big hot-button issue in Saudi Arabia. That's a hot-button issue in Rome, which is not in favor of that, being named the capital mm-hmm. of Israel. And it's also going to be, of course, a hot-button issue in the Israeli-Palestinian equation.
Shall we only have a minute or two? Speaking of the Vatican, speaking of Rome, Calista Gingrich, as in Newt Gingrich's
yeah.
wife, about to be the ambassador to the Vatican?
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
It's puzzling. I don't know why that would happen. I can't tell you I have any great take on
well,
this.
Well, like, I bet in all fairness, a lot of ambassadorships for Democrats and Republicans yeah. are payback for
oh,
support.
Usually,
and Gingrich himself has not gotten the job.
And
right.
Newt Gingrich is writing a book about Trump. Talk about someone that's been defending him left and right.
Yeah,
Newt has.
It's old school. I mean, it's absolutely the most common thing in the world, particularly at the Vatican, to sort of dole something out to a party favorite, right?
Yeah.
Our own dear mayor of mm-hmm. Boston was named as the ambassador to the Vatican.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, is anybody who was the ambassador to the Vatican under Barack Obama? Is it, do we, does anybody know?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Uh-oh.
I don't know
either. Got me.
I'm really.
I should know that. I was just.
I don't know either.
Charlie, one thing I know you do know for sure is you're, I think it's Wednesday night, going to one of our favorite venues ever. You're going to be doing something at the Boston Public Library Wednesday night. You know, we do every Tuesday and Friday there.
We love every single minute. I wish we were overlapping.
So do I. What are you doing Wednesday
night? So anyway, Wednesday night, we are there with the Holocaust Memorial Museum is hosting an event, and I'm really proud to be moderating this event.
Oh, that's great.
And we're going to be talking about the rise of extremism, and we're going to just be looking at this issue in the digital age. How is it that we're watching, you know, authoritarianism rising around the world, right? And you can see this in so many manifestations, whether it's Brexit or the French vote, or you could even say right here in the United States, as some would see it. But the question is, what is the digital expression of that? So really powerful. You know that article by David Frum that was in The Atlantic?
I quote it all the time
because it's really important. But basically, Frum said something chilling. He said, brown shirts won't appear on the streets in the digital age because that's not where the power is. It's online. And there are the equivalents to authoritarian thugs who are trolls on the internet who are trying to manipulate and control their messages. And that's the thing they're going to fear. So we're going to be discussing that, and it is open to the public.
Have you done anything at the library yet?
I've never moderated it.
Really, it is a great venue on about a dozen levels. It's fabulous.
Can't wait to go.
Wednesday night, what time? Do you know?
I think it's at 7 p.m., but I will have that on our site if anyone wants
to
check.
Great, and we'll announce it Wednesday. If you remind us, we'll let people know. Charlie, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much, Charlie Sennett. Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie, thank you. Coming up, instead of seeing the world through the eyes of the white working class male, in his latest book, writer Dennis Lehane turns things over to a female protagonist. I'm so excited to talk to him. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And Dennis Lehane, the writer who's given us Gone Baby Gone, Shutter Island, Mystic River, and so many more, has a new book. It's entitled Since We Fell. No, it's not about the destiny of a nation after a TV personality became president. Rather, it's a psychological thriller with Rachel Childs as the protagonist, whose search for the identity of her father spirals into something much darker. Dennis will be at the Brattle Theater tonight at 7 o'clock at an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. To get tickets, you go to harvard.com. And by the way, much more relevant to me, he was the commencement speaker at my kids' graduation at Emerson yesterday. Dennis, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm just going to be an unabashed groupie here, fawning all over this interview because I'm a big...
love unabashed groupies. Unabashed groupies are the best groupies.
Totally, because I'm a big, huge fan. And I love this book because, as I said to you in the hallway, Dennis, it didn't have somebody getting their feet in cement and dumped over the side of the boat in the first...
No, it just has a woman shooting her husband in the chest.
In line one, right?
Literally on the first page.
It did. Yeah, another boat theme. You're big into these deaths on boats.
Apparently,
over the back of a boat. Yeah. But tell us, because this is a little bit different. I mean, this is from a woman's perspective and very much a family drama. So tell people, give us people a hint of what the book's about.
Well, it's about a woman who has agoraphobia and I always thought if you had agoraphobia, what's your greatest fear? I think it would be that there was a world going on outside that you weren't privy to and anything could be happening in it. So it's this woman who's agoraphobic, but apparently she has a perfect marriage to a perfect guy, as if such a thing could exist. And she walks outside one day and she sees the guy in a place he's not supposed to be. And that's the driving engine of the plot. But really what I wanted to do first was dive into who this woman was and how she got to where she got. And so the first 100 pages are really a journey through this woman's life and a very conflicted relationship she has with her mother. And a search she has to figure out who her father was.
You know,
Boston Globe reporter who turned into a TV star.
But you saw a little Western Mass thing, which is not your typical kind of deal. Sort of the Smith Five Sister, whatever the hell they're called, Five College Access
Seven
kind
Sisters,
of thing.
Five Colleges.
The region of the Five Colleges.
That's right.
Pioneer Valley.
Happy Valley.
One of the reasons I could relate to this book, I have to say, is because Rachel is in a search for her father. And as Marjorie knows, sadly, I found mine, which is where...
He was in
true.
Jail for a few years.
But... You know, one of the things, as I'm reading this, I read a little bit about it before I got the book last week. You sold the movie rights in 2015.
Was it 2015? It might
have
been.
That's what it said in the account I read.
Okay,
When you're writing something, and you were still writing the book, right?
Yeah.
Obviously?
Yeah.
When you're writing a book and you know it's going to be a movie.
Yeah.
Are you writing for both? Or no. You're saying to yourself, I'm writing the book, and then I'll later either write the screenplay or somebody else will
No,
do
that's
it.
Why I doubled down so hard on the first 100 pages of this book, which you'll never see in a movie, mm-hmm. period. It's the first thing that gets thrown out. I wanted to
you
tell...
You mean the background about the family?
The entire journey that she has, family, the mother, everything.
No shrink
that would
time?
That would never make it into a film. So it was the first thing I knew as a screenwriter. Well, none of that's going
to
work.
Well, wouldn't you have to get some sense of... The mom's wackadoodle.
You get a little, but nothing hardcore. You get the feeling that she grew up with a troubled mother. But in a movie, it's all about, boom, you get to the story. You get to the meat of it fast, which I don't write books that way. I write scripts that way.
So, but wait a second. Was your point, we both interrupted you, I should say,
yes,
not just
okay.
me for a change. But was your point that that's one of the reasons you wrote the first 100 pages as you wrote them? Or did it answer my question saying, no, it's a whole totally different animal because the first 100 pages would never be in a movie?
It's a totally different animal, in my opinion. I think outside, you remove narrative DNA, the only thing, which is what a script and a book have in common. Otherwise, they have no more in common than an apple and a giraffe. They really don't. I mean, they're just two totally different beasts, and you approach them from two totally different ways, and particularly a film script. You know, I work in TV a lot, and... TV, you have a lot more authorship and you have a lot more pride of ownership. But a script.
Really?
Yeah, but a script, you're one of 150 people.
So when you were doing something for The Wire, you felt you had more input there than you did, like in Shutter Island or Mystic River or this when it gets read into a movie?
Absolutely, because, you know, look, I'm working on a TV show right now with David Kelly. I write lines, they show up
did
coming
you get to
up.
Read Michelle Pfeiffer?
I have not. But David and I have been working pretty close on this, and every time we write, I write a line, it's coming out of Brendan Gleeson's mouth 3 days later. I mean,
oh, wow.
it's wonderful. So that's total ownership of what we're doing. When I write a script, I hand it over. I don't even print them. I just press send. And they go out to the studio, and what the studio does with them is the studio's business. I got no power in it. I got no agency. It's done.
But, you know, everybody's always complaining about how nobody reads anymore. I wonder whether when something that you've written turns into a big-time movie, it must do wonders for people going back to read the book.
If the movie's successful, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does a lot. But if the movie's not successful, no, there's no relation.
Well, you've had a lot of successful movies, though.
I have, and I've had one recent unsuccessful.
Yeah,
so
right?
I think, yeah. So Live by Night did not do well at the box office, so I don't think that helped. It didn't boost my sales at all. So,
but Mystic River was a huge hit.
Mystic River was so big that it's my only number one bestseller.
Did you get to miss Clint Eastwood?
Did I get to meet Clint Eastwood?
Yeah
a lot. Yeah, we spent a lot of time together.
So what'd you think?
He's great.
Is
he's
he
the
great?
Classiest human being I've ever dealt with in Hollywood. He spoiled me. He wrecked me.
Yeah, how about his politics?
That's his business.
Okay, so he wasn't proselytizing about that.
God,
kind of
no, stuff. No, nor will we. You know, you don't go back and forth on that conversation. I don't get people who this divide. We must remember that this divide in this country right now, this savage divide between people where they can't even talk about their differences, is recent. It's really recent. I got plenty of friends who are Republicans. I'm a Democrat. You know, so who cares? And we all get along. But that's a difference between that and this banana stuff that's going on right now. This craziness.
I know.
Where you have to be an ideologue on one side or the other, and it's madness.
That's the voice of Dennis Lehane. His new book is Since We Fell. Can you tell the story quickly you told yesterday, speaking of Clint Eastwood, about telling your father about Clint Eastwood?
Yeah, my old man was he was just not connected in any way, shape, or form to celebrity life. He just could care less. And just a working class guy. And I remember when I made the deal with Clint, I called my parents, and they were both on two different phones, which the parents do these days, or used to do. They retired to Florida, and they get two phones. And they answered, and I said, I made this movie deal with Clint Eastwood, and he's going to do Mystic River as a movie. And my mother said, oh, my. She was so excited. And my father said, who's Clint Eastwood?
Oh, my God.
He had no clue.
And then you're then going to say the two of them have a fight on the phone.
Yeah,
back
they had
and
a fight on the phone back and forth.
There.
Like my mother was like, they lose you. That's the problem with the two phone thing. And she was like, oh, Mike, you know who he is. And he was, I have no idea.
Not
and
even
she
Dirty
said,
Harry?
She said he was in Westerns. And my father said, was he on Bonanza? And she said no. And he said, then I don't know who the hell he was, because that was the last TV show my father ever watched, was Bonanza. And then he met Clint, and it was a hysterical moment. He meets Clint on the set. And they treated them like royalty. They were so classy.
Nice.
And then he comes out, and Clint meets my mom, and my mom loses all power of speech, and she just stares at her hand that he shook like she's never going to wash it again. And then I turn around and find my old man talking to Clint, and he's just like, he's telling him how much he loved his movies and what they and what they meant to his sons and all this other stuff. And I was like, and he left. And I said, you still have no idea who he was, do you? And he goes, not a clue.
Remember we went a couple of weeks ago to see The Good, the Bad, the Ugly?
Yeah.
That was one of his early movies. Remember that?
Fabulous. I mean, it's a masterpiece. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And you forget. When I mean, he looks pretty good in his old age, but he was pretty.
Are you starstruck by any of these people? I mean, you're working class kids. Everybody listening to the show
knows
of Boston. You're not.
No, I think I know who I would be starstruck by.
Who would that be?
I think Bill Murray.
Really?
I really feel if I met Bill Murray, I might get a little kind of stuttery.
And what's that about?
He's just the coolest dude on the planet. He always has been since I grew up on him. And I was predicting Bill Murray was way greater than Bill Murray was way before anybody else. So when he started to do dramatic work, when he started to expand. I'm in awe of the guy. I feel like if I met him, I'd stutter. But otherwise, no, nobody.
We're talking to Dennis Lehane, his new book.
Since We Fell.
Since We Fell. I didn't take the title off the thing so I can even read it. Since We Fell, I got the thing still sticking on there. And you're out in Southern California now. And before we ask you about Southern California, I'm interested because you grew up locally here and have a lot of – apparently you told a lot of great stories yesterday about growing up locally here. We've been accused in Boston of being first Michael Che said on Saturday Night Live. Then we had this whole thing with the Red Sox where the Adam Jones got the peanuts thrown at him and the N-word used. Yeah. And the guy who was there with his biracial son for his sixth birthday party, there was a fan that made fun of the Kenyan woman that was singing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of that when you hear your hometown called the most racist city in America? Now you're living on the other coast.
I've lived in some pretty racist places in my life, so I don't know that I would define Boston as the most racist. I think those, again, we're talking about this idea of just pushing everything to the extremes. You know, oh, it's the most racist. No, is it a racist city? Absolutely. Do you see a lot of racism here? Do we have a troubled racial history in this city? Absolutely. 100% own it. But is it the most racist? I don't know. I've been to parts of, you know, Alabama and Mississippi that were truly terrifying. And one of the most racist conversations that I ever had, or one where somebody was trying to make the point that it was okay to be racist, was in New York City. You know, so it was a cab driver in New York City, and it was just 6 months ago. I literally had him pull over and got out of the cab. And I mean, so I see it everywhere. It's not a Boston problem. It's an American problem. It's a European problem. I mean, it's a problem, period. So I just don't, I would say, you know, hold this in two different hands. Do I think that Boston is a racist city? Yes, I think there's plenty of racism in Boston. Do I think it's the most racist city? No. I don't think you can qualify such a thing.
But, you know, it seems to me, and you live there now, that one of the things you always hear about California is that it's much less obsessed with where your father went to college.
Oh,
are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are you Jewish?
They could care less.
Yeah, it's very different. So is that because everybody kind of rolled west and everybody hasn't been there that long? Or what's your analysis?
No, I don't know. California in general is just kind of breezy, man. I mean, everybody's just kind of, you know, there's the flip side of that is what people say. There's no there. That the people there can be very polite and they can be very nice. But if you try to drill down, you know, and I believe this old adage about, you know, I do believe this, having lived it. I believe that the difference between the South and the North is that in the South, everybody is friendly without being intimate. And in the North, everybody's intimate without being friendly. You know? And I prefer the latter. I prefer people who are intimate without being friendly. But I'm in a place where everybody's friendly without being intimate.
Yeah.
California's kind of like that. Yeah. Everybody's super nice, unbelievably nice. Everywhere you go, everybody's so pleasant. It's weird.
Stop for pedestrians.
Hey, oh yeah. Oh
absolutely.
God. Yeah. And I feel like I'm from another. I'm like the alien from another planet sometimes. There, I still feel that. I've been there 4 years, and I'll never feel like a Californian.
So how can you know when you say you never feel like a Californian? You wrote a piece, I think it was a month ago, which was terrific. I thought, and I don't know if people know, you worked with abused kids earlier in your life. You wrote a great piece about why the Patriots should not sign, and luckily they didn't. Adrian Peterson,
absolutely.
Who obviously beat the crap out of his kid, is I think.
And the trolling I got on that was stunning.
Saying what kind of stuff?
Basically, that I had no right to say that because I write books about violence, and it was like, and then they would say things like, "Well, he apologized." I'm like, he didn't really apologize. He shoved dirt in a child's mouth, his own flesh and blood, stripped down his pants, and then beat him with wood. And to see people
amongst other places.
I know, and to see people defend that was sickening. That was one of the most sickening things I've experienced as a writer, was the response to that article. You know. And so, I just doubled down. I'm just like, there's nothing more egregious, in my personal opinion, than to beat your own flesh and blood like that, to beat anybody like that, but your own flesh and blood.
Well, hopefully most sane people would agree with that, but to separate the trolls from that piece of to the other piece of criticism, I never even thought about. Do you take heat generally for writing so much about violence? And I assume the implication is that you essentially perpetrate it by writing it. Is that the point?
Which is
but
insane.
Is that the point they're making?
That seems to be the point. And you can't argue with small minds. I mean, at the end of the day, you can't, you know, if you're going to make, if that's your point, well, you know, good luck. You know, there's nothing you can do with that.
We're talking to Dennis Lehane. You know, one other thing you also mentioned, talking about your Boston connections. He wrote the Adrian Peterson thing, which I thought was great. And you mentioned, you made some reference to David Ortiz yesterday in your commencement address.
Yeah.
I'm a Philly kid, and I moved away from Philly about 400 years ago.
Right.
I check the Phillies box score every day, even though I don't know one player on the
Boston
team.
I read Boston.com probably four times a day.
Is that really true?
Yeah, easily. I keep up, you know, I keep up with all of this. You know, I was following the market basket thing 2 years ago. Like, you
wasn't
know, like I was
story?
like I was eating popcorn on the side. This is my town, man. You know, so I'll never be. Somebody tried to get me to buy Rams tickets. I said, what are you insane? You know, I have a friend who's from Boston who said, you know, I lives out there now. And he said, he called me one time and said, you want to go to a Dodgers game? And I was like, I'm not going to become a Dodgers fan, man. What are you, crazy? Yeah, that's no.
So we're talking to Dennis Lehane. The new book is Since We Fell. And you know him from a million great books, Gone Baby Gone, Mystic River. I mentioned that before. Shutter Island, The Given Day, Live by Night. How did this happen for you? I mean, you grew up in Boston.
Yeah.
You were kind of right at the tail end of, well, actually, you were at the tail end. You were right in the middle of the busing thing, weren't you?
I was a kid. I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I was a little kid, but my brothers were part of it. They got bused.
So yeah. How did you move from a regular kid going to school to be able to write these great books and screenplays? How'd this happen?
It was the only thing I was good at. It truly was. And I don't have any other talents. There's nothing else I can do. I'm not gifted in any other area. I'm not particularly smart in any other area. I'm good at one thing, which is making stuff up to the degree that people pay me money for it.
And you talked about going to the library all the time. That was
Yeah, that was everything.
Where'd you go to the library?
I went to the Upham's Corner branch.
Every day?
Pretty much. A lot.
And
I
just hung around there.
I would go and I'd just take out books and I'd read them and I'd bring them home. And then they would rat me out. It's amazing to think in this day and age now, but they would literally rat me out to my mother if I was reading age-inappropriate books, which I always was. Libraries saved my life. Libraries changed my entire life.
So did you take a lot of grief for being a little nerdy bookworm?
Yeah. You have to, you know, I was forged in fire, man. You know, like there's no question. Everybody was like, it wasn't like I got beat up all the time, but it was kind of like, he's a little suspect.
Where'd you go to school?
St. Margaret's. Parochial, and then I went to, it's now Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Well, the school is now John Paul II Academy. Yeah. And then I went to BC High, and that was ground zero for a lot of fun stuff at that point. And
for what fun stuff?
Well, that's where, the pedophiles, several of the pedophiles were. So
Did you realize that at the
Yeah,
time?
We knew it. But this is the horror of all of that, which I think, has been captured well finally. But the horror of it is they didn't go after kids like me who came from grounded homes who were very confident, in who we were. They went after the weak. And that's the worst of it. And they would never approach us. They would sort of float near us.
Yeah.
I'm talking about me and my friends who came from similar backgrounds. They would float near us. They would try something. I remember a guy putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, oh, son, you have such a long face. And I was like, yeah, I was born with it, father. And I kept walking.
So, well, you captured that whole thing. I mean, it wasn't priests, but in Mystic River, I mean, that was just that whole horror of how that pedophilia happens.
Thin the herd. And they went after the weak one in Mystic River. It was like there's three kids. One's just way too tough to go near. One is confident in who he is because of his parental – he won the parental lottery. And the other one was weak and confused and lost, and that's who they grab.
Yeah.
And
I thought that was a really good adaptation of your book.
I think so. I can't judge them.
Yeah, I thought it was because, it's one of those things if you read the book first, you go to the movie and you're disappointed.
Right.
But I remember going to see that movie and I was not disappointed. I thought they did a really good job. That great cast, Tim Robbins.
Amazing cast.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. Everybody seems to think it's great. But I got to take some of it on faith because the author can never quite honestly see it.
Yeah.
You can't. It's your world is in your head in a totally different way. Then you see it on the screen. And it's like, oh.
You know, Marjorie and I were talking before you came in, Dennis Lehane, is how much, I know this is no surprise to you, how much we got off all the references of things we knew. It's sort of like in all your books for a Bostonian. She went to Smith. My other daughter, who didn't graduate from Emerson, yesterday went to Smith. So when you mentioned that Rachel's mother went to Smith.
Right.
And Boston
Athenaeum, all these great.
Every great writer I know deals in detail. I mean, Marjorie, when she was a columnist at the Herald, that was one of your great skills.
And he said something nice to me
What did he say?
When he came in, it was like the biggest thrill of my life.
What did he say?
We were in some panel. Yeah. I don't even remember. Do you remember being on the panel?
I don't remember the panel. Well, I remember being on the panel with you.
We were sitting in the front row somewhere. I have no idea. But you were sitting next to me, and you said to me something nice about my column. I was like, ha!
Oh, I was at that forum afterwards. Dennis said to me, who was she again? So do you get off on that? I mean, obviously, that's part of the narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, the detail is what draws people in. But as a Bostonian, or as a Massachusetts, if that's a word, do you get off on writing those things?
Absolutely. When I was a kid, I used to read like Parker or Higgins, and I'd be like, oh, he put Boston Sand and Gravel in. Or, you know, whatever it was. It was always just so exciting. You're like, this is my town. Like, look, the weirdest thing about Bostonians, this is not true of most places. I think you see it in Chicago, too. But even out in L.A., you know, the people who are from Boston, we're all just homers. We're just like we're unrepentant homers for our city. It doesn't mean we love it in blindness. It just means we love it. Like we're crazy about it.
Yeah.
And did you see that great when Seth Meyers did that parody Boston movie?
Oh, yeah.
Boston Accent
was
what it was called.
God.
Off Spotlight, right?
It was
off Spotlight.
Great.
Wasn't it off Spotlight?
No,
I thought he was just doing a parody of Spotlight.
No, he did one called Boston Accent, and it was all just bad accents. And at one point he said and then they will, of course, contain the moment when two guys talk obsessively about locations in Boston. And it was just two guys on the phone going, I'll meet you in Somerville. No, how about Melrose? No, how about Brockton? No, then the announcer says, this conversation goes on for another 10 minutes.
That's, oh, it's so true. Yeah. You were talking about the Casey Affleck thing that they did on Saturday Night Live about when he's at Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah.
He gets in a fight in the parking lot at Dunkin' Donuts, and his whole life is about Dunkin' Donuts.
Cut your nails.
I'm not smoking.
I love that
great.
Scene.
But,
hey,
know,
Dennis. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, because I left Smith College to go to college in California. And
because she couldn't get a date is what she said for years.
But as much as I love the physical beauty of it, because I thought it was really beautiful in the ocean and the cliffs and, you know, Muir Woods and all that stuff. But there was something very, like the center was not there.
There's no center.
Exactly.
There's
and I had to come home.
Right.
So how much do you miss it?
Terribly.
Yeah.
I miss it so terribly. But I feel like, I'll tell you another story about my dad. And I'm doing really well out there, and I'm having a lot of fun, and my daughters love it. And so I complain about it all the time. So let me put it in perspective. My father spent his entire life complaining about having to leave Ireland. His entire life. Oh, if I could just get back to the old sod. It was just constant, right? So it's what he did. It was his thing. So then when I was finally marginally successful, I went to Ireland. And real estate was cheap at the time. And I came back, and then my father just retired. And I said, you know, Dad, I was thinking, I got a little bit of money. I could maybe put a down payment on a house for you back in Ireland, you know? We could retire there. And he goes, why the hell would I want to do that? You know? It was like, wow, I may be that guy now. I may be like, it's like if suddenly it was like, oh, you got to move back to Boston. I think I would love to have a place here.
Yeah.
But could I give it up? I don't know at this point. I'm 4 years in now. I'm really used to its rhythms.
It's beautiful.
I'm right on the ocean. I live in a town that's kind of like Hull. It's the last of the working class beach towns. And it's great. I mean, and so, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I go back and forth. But I hang with nothing but Boston expats. I mean, I'm working with David Kelly. You know, I see Casey every now and then. I mean, it's just sort of like that's our thing.
He was great in that movie.
That was the performance of a lifetime. That was incredible.
So I let you get away with this, though, before I finish asking you. Yeah. I was actually before. So you spend your time in the library reading all these books, and that's how you got to be able to write such good books. But how did the first step happen where you – I mean, you dropped out of school.
I dropped out of Emerson, then I dropped out of UMass, and then I went to my parents and I said, you know, I think I should major in creative writing. And they said, well, you're not good at anything else. So, yeah, you might as well think about it. And they said, if you can get a scholarship and you can teach with that, then great. You know, go for it. So I got a scholarship to this little tiny college down in St. Petersburg, Florida, and that's where I went. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life in a lot of ways.
And how did you get your first book published?
I just sent it out, and ultimately I got hooked up with through a friend to an agent who took 6 months to read it, and then she read it, and then she started sending it out, and she kept getting pregnant. And so she, so the book would kind of like, she'd take her eye off the ball for a little bit, and then she'd get back on. But the book kept getting rejected, and then after 2 years, somebody said, you know, hey, we want to publish it. And that was it. It was a long run. It was 2 years. It was 2 years out there. They just kept saying, I got conditional rejections. If I would change the fact that the main female character was a battered wife, they would publish it. And I said, no, I won't change it.
What was your first book?
Drink Before the War.
Oh, okay. So. That was the first one.
Dennis Lehane, we mentioned that you had done writing for The Wire, and I assume people know Boardwalk Empire. And hey, by the way, later today we have this guy on we have every week who's head of the Blyer School of TV and Popular Culture at Syracuse, who's a TV kind of guy. He thinks the greatest series in the history of television was The Wire. But we talk almost every week with him about how brilliant the writing is, which is why it's the golden age of television, he thinks.
Yep.
And so do we.
I agree.
What's the writing on television that you most are drawn to, that you think is terrific in 2017 that is not yours?
Oh, without a doubt. The Americans. Mm-hmm. Better Call Saul. Mm. Fargo.
Jim's favorite shows.
They are my favorite shows,
And you kind of forget this because of its popularity, but Game of Thrones is a masterpiece. I mean, the writing on Game of Thrones is off the charts. So, I would say those. I'm going to give you my best Hollywood moment, period, hands
Please.
Down. 2 weeks ago, I got a special invite to go to a private screening of the restored version of Michael Mann's Heat, right?
No.
And I got the invite from Michael himself. So I was like, couldn't be cooler. And I go, and I'm sitting down beside this guy, and we're getting psyched. We're like, it's Heat, you know, we're just looking at each other. And all of a sudden, as we're talking, you know, I realize we're the same age. We're vibing on the movie the same way. And I realize I'm talking to Vince Gilligan, who created Breaking Bad.
Of course.
And then I was just like, oh, my God, Vince. And he was like, Dennis? And then we started having this mutual admiration moment. You know, I spent the next 3 hours watching Heat, nudging, laughing at all the same moments, you know, clapping at the same moments with Vince Gilligan. And I thought, this is the coolest moment of my 4 years in L.A.
He's good, but he's no Bill Murray. So, Dennis Lehane, before you go, one of the lines you said yesterday, empathy or mercy are seen as symbols of weakness. You're talking about the current affairs and politics. And you urge people, young kids, obviously, graduating, to vote. And obviously millennials didn't vote in the same kinds of numbers as adults did, even though voting was pathetic, frankly, too. But voting, how does one turn around this mess, according to Dennis Lehane? I mean, voting is an important step, but it surely isn't the whole. How do you ensure that empathy and mercy are things that people feel are important qualities that we should all embrace and exhibit rather than signs of weakness? What has to happen?
We have to turn back. We have to turn back from the rage. We have to turn back from. I think a lot of our rage is steeped in myth. And that's part of the problem, that there was once this America that was so much better than the America we're living in now. You know, make America great again was the slogan, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I felt like wearing a hat that said America is great. What is wrong with you people? It's not perfect, but it is pretty fantastic. Go around the world, check out some other places, my friends. So I feel like there's this strange misplaced rage. I get it if you don't have a job. I understand that. And I feel like the Democrats left the Midwest holding the bag, and that is on them without a doubt. So I feel like the Republicans figured out how to speak to that rage. But there's a lot of very misplaced rage. You see people who are perfectly fine. They're perfectly adequate. Their lives are going pretty good because they grew up in this country. And they want to sit there and they want to say, oh, we're giving the store away to the immigrants, or we're giving the store away to the special interests. And it's, no, we're not. No, we're not. It actually happens to be, I hate to sound like an Occupy Wall Streeter, but it actually happens to be the 1% is taking way too much cream off the top at an appalling rate, and at a rate that their parents would be appalled by. I think we've turned into a nation of HUDs. You remember that? You remember HUD? Mm-hmm. And the point of HUD was that the son got all of his father's rigidity and he got all of his sort of strength, but he got none of his heart and none of his mercy. He got all of his greed and he got all of his ascension to power, but he got none of his equanimity. He got none of his understanding of other people. And so we've turned into that thing. And I think, you know, there's a lot going on in this country right now that would be an embarrassment to our fathers. I really do feel that.
I just want to make sure you were talking about the Paul Newman HUD. God, that was a great
Absolutely.
Movie.
Absolutely. You know.
You look pretty good in that movie, too. Not that I'm a superficial person or anything like that.
No, that's okay. You can call it up.
Okay. Dennis, great
Thank
to see you.
Good very, luck very much. It was a big thrill, and I can't wait to get home so I can proceed with Since We Fell. It's a thriller and a page-turner, and it's really great. And Dennis, the book, of course, Since We Fell, I just said that, is going to be at the Brown Theater tonight, 7 o'clock, for an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. If you want to get tickets, you go to harvard.com. That's tonight, 7 o'clock, at the Brattle Theater. Harvard.com. Thank you very much, Dennis, for coming in. Coming up, we're making JFK Centennial by way of a new book. Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley and Stephen Kennedy Smith join us to talk about that next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
Those words still resonate today, more than 50 years on. That, of course, was President John F. Kennedy in 63 giving a commencement address at American University, where he laid out a route for world peace at a time when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were facing the possibility of an escalating nuclear arms race. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Before we introduce our guest, we should say we made a mistake with Dennis Lehane. He will be at the Brattle Theater tonight at 6 o'clock, not 7 o'clock. Is that right, Marjorie?
Yes,
6
I
o'clock.
Goofed it up.
At the Brattle. That address you just heard, among JFK's other historic speeches, including commentary, hundreds of documentary photos, many of which I'd never seen before, have been published in the definitive compendium entitled JFK, A Vision for America. It's edited by JFK's nephew, Stephen Kennedy Smith. Stephen, it's great to see you again.
Thanks
for being here. And presidential historian Douglas Brinkley. And Doug, it's great to see you again. It's published in commemoration of JFK's centennial birth. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here. And the book is spectacular. I mean, it really is.
You know, congratulations. I mean, I thought I was pretty well versed in all these pictures, and I thought I remember most of these speeches, and I didn't remember. I mean, this is all new stuff to me. So tell us what you were trying to do. What were you trying to do with this book?
Yeah, so I think what we really wanted to do was make John F. Kennedy relevant to contemporary America. So I asked the people who I thought were the best and brightest of our current age to comment on one of John F. Kennedy's great speeches. And then, of course, Doug wrote a stunning narrative of President Kennedy's life. And then we also partnered with Getty Images, which is the largest archive image of the 60s and JFK. So we have all of the great documentary photographers of the 60s, and that was really the Mount Olympus of American documentary photography: Henri Dumas, Jacques Lowe, Burton Barinski, Cornell Kappa, and everyone in the book, from Conan O'Brien to Don DeLillo to the Dalai Lama, literally. And, of course, six of our nation's great historians, Doug and David McCullough, two secretaries of state, two Nobel Prize winners in economics. It's really a spectacular collection of brilliant thinkers on JFK.
Before we get to the historian in the room, was this – I mean, this is not just a project. Your mother was JFK's brother, a sister. Does that – how much more complicated does that make that for you? Stephen, this is not just a project about a major historical figure of the 20th century.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have to tell you that reading some of these commentaries by people as they came in actually made me cry. And, you know, I really did this because even if I wasn't a member of the Kennedy family, you know, the reason I really did the book is because during the campaign, I read a speech that he gave in Amherst where he said, "Our national strength matters, but the spirit which informs and controls that strength matters even more." And the men who create power make an indispensable contribution to democracy, but the men who criticize power make an equally indispensable contribution. And I thought, this needs to come to the attention of the country.
I agree. And Douglas Brinkley, I have to say, you know, I said this to Marjorie before, and I said, should I mention this early on or am I going to ruin the whole field? So I'll ruin it right away. Yeah, I'm watching you the other night calling Donald Trump a tyrant or whatever it is you said, which I think was apt. You can't read a page of this book, nor can you, even if you try, or read a speech that was so elegant with every sentence perfect and enlightened and inspirational and not step back and think Donald Trump. Is that unfair to you two and the book, or is that the reality of the world in 2017?
I think it's the reality of the world, but the contrast between Kennedy and Trump could not be greater. I mean, John F. Kennedy's whole M.O. was American identity, of finding a common American cause, one of them being going to the moon by the end of the decade, mm-hmm. which became a completely bipartisan effort. I mean, we ponied up billions to do it as a unifying factor. Let's beat the Soviet Union to space. When you look at Trump, you see his reckless language, his lack of using proper oratory to uplift people. He has a really no sense of history. JFK was a constant reader of history and a writer. It used to be said you couldn't find John F. Kennedy without reading a book, even in a pub or a beach. He always had a book with him. I got to talk to Donald Trump, and he told me he never read a book of American history before. I tried to help him. I said, well, Mr. Trump, maybe when you were young, you read a book, childhood book about Lincoln or something. He said, nope. No, I don't do it. I don't do that. That's what you guys do, not me.
Sitting in the same chair as you about a week ago, Douglas Brinkley, was somebody you have surely heard of, and he's in your book. David McCullough was there. I literally thought David's head was going to pop off when he mentioned the ignorance of history thing, which, as you know, to him is about as important as it gets. You know, one of the things, Douglas Brinkley, that I found interesting, is Alan Brinkley a relative of yours?
No, he's not.
Alan Brinkley wrote a piece in The Atlantic, which I had an interesting fact, which I'm sure both you know, which I was not aware of, is part I was aware of. One, that JFK has been much more popular with the public in these intervening years than he has been with historians in terms of rankings. And the little factoid that Brinkley had in there, the other Brinkley had, which I loved, is he got 49.7% of the vote. Yet 3 years later, 59% of the people said they voted for him. And right after he died, 65% of the people said they voted for him, which is just great. But why the divide between what historians think, at least to date, of JFK and what people think?
Let me tell you that I wrote a biography of Rosa Parks, and I spent time in Montgomery, Alabama, and I met and interviewed around 30, I think it was 38 people that were on the bus with Rosa Parks, but there were only 8 people on the bus. So out of my 38, 30 had to be lying.
Oh, my God.
And they didn't even think they're lying. It just becomes passed on. Oh, I was on the bus with Rosa Parks, meaning once John F. Kennedy became an icon, people would say, oh, yeah, I voted Kennedy. You know, and they forgot. I was more stunned to see after John F. Kennedy's first 100 days, he had something like 73% public approval rating, that short out of a tense election at 60 with
Nixon.
But
getting to the question of why he's seen more favorably from the public, my analysis as a non-historian is that people like you, and I don't mean you individually, but your colleagues, judge outcomes. And I knew this before, but I know it more now from having read this. Kennedy, it's what he started that reached culmination, whether it's, you know, the Civil Rights Act shortly after he died, clearly inspired initially by him. Is that why there's the divide? Because the generic you, are judging outcomes and the public is looking about what he inspired and
exactly
is that what it is?
The public loves John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. They put them very high. Scholars put them high but lower. Now, look, both Kennedy and Reagan are in the top 10 on scholars' list. Pretty good place to be. Obama came in number 12 in the recent polls. So they're both top 10 presidents. But if you look at public opinion polls, you'll see Reagan and Kennedy sometimes 1, 2, 3, or 4, where with scholars are judging that. Because we scholars judge criteria in a relationship with Congress, moral authority, kind of a commander in chief. You know, we break it down into so many categories to do analysis.
That's the voice of I'm sorry, go
That's
ahead.
Okay. We're talking with Stephen Kennedy Smith and presidential historian Douglas Brinkley. The new book is JFK, A Vision for America. You know, as I said before, I didn't know a lot of the stuff, or if I did, I'd certainly forgotten it. I did not know that John Kennedy signed a bill creating the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is now in some under some threat. We don't know what's going to happen with the, from the Trump administration. But Stephen, tell people some of the other things that kind of were under the radar that we may not have known about that you talk about in this book. There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So one thing is that I didn't realize that he was an active working journalist, that he wrote articles for the Hearst newspapers, and that he covered the UN convention in 1948. I also didn't realize that he actually conceived of the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities. And, you know, that he and Schlesinger and his other advisors were reading about the power of markets and the way that they would kind of make the individual feel alienated and not really in touch with their creative abilities. And they wanted to counterweight the power of the market and what they thought was the disorienting effects of the rise of technology and mass consumerism by creating an entity that would foster, you know, connection through the arts. So they had this kind of really visionary, thinking about where the future was going and how they wanted to build public institutions, you know, to support democracy.
Yeah, there was a real, I mean, it was a total, we are moving onward and upward kind of time in the United States of America. You know, you mentioned Douglas Brinkley about Kennedy always reading books, and I remember reading, you know, he was sick a lot, and he spent a lot of time when you're sick reading books because the TV wasn't around in those days. I mean, and then of course he was in the war and had this harrowing experience with a PT boat that everybody knows about. I wonder, when you look at presidents, how much has being in wars, serving the military, mattered in terms of how they operate as chief executives?
I think it's mattered a lot in American history. We don't have time on the show to just start rattling off all the generals that later became president, but starting with, you know, Washington and Zachary Taylor and Ulysses S. Grant to Benjamin Harrison, on and on and on. And in what JFK had going for him was like Theodore Roosevelt. They were from wealthy families and could have found a way out of their wars. But TR in the Spanish-American War said, send me. I'm going to go to the Alamo and at San Antonio and get Rough Riders, and we're going to go and take the fight to Spain and Cuba. And you see John F. Kennedy, who had every reason to get a deferment in World War II. He had a horrible back problem, to put it mildly. And he decided he had to work to sneak his way to get in. He wanted to see combat, and he got to lead that PT-109. And that military service made you a leader among men. It became a great equalizer. When you're seeing people die, your friends killed, what your bank book is or what college you went to scarcely matters. And I think he came out of that World War II experience, John F. Kennedy, feeling that he was something better than just the child of a wealthy family, that he was a regular American citizen. And then he wrote Profiles in Courage.
Yes.
And that book, I mean, you talk about resonating in the age of Trump. Right now, today, I am praying that there will be one Republican profile of courage. Mm. I would say John McCain has shown some in the current crisis, but we need more of meaning Republican senators that say we need a special prosecutor on Donald Trump. We need Republicans to have their profiles and courage moments unfold.
Stephen, what'd your mother think of this book?
Oh, she loves it. She really liked it.
Were you
a lot.
Nervous
I
about showing her the book?
I made sure to put her picture in the book, so that was covered on that.
But well, your picture's in the book early on as a little tiny kid on the cover of Life magazine.
You know, we should explain before Stephen. I don't mean to interrupt you, but this is like a scrapbook in many ways. There's prose and there's the speeches and there's the comments on Kennedy, and then every page is chock full of these pictures. So
and even it's in chronological order,
yeah,
too,
so
which is
even
great.
If you're not a huge reader, you will get totally drawn in. I mean, there's how many? Hundreds and hundreds of pictures in here, correct?
Yeah, there's over 500 pictures. We went through 36,000 images of the 60s. We had a photo team of five people. And, of course, I'm on the board of the Kennedy Library, so we were able to access all of the family documents. One thing that I was going to mention related to the war service is I have a letter on my wall that my mother gave me which is a letter from President Kennedy to my grandfather, and they were writing under an alias about his back problems because he didn't want the censors to know that he might have been pulled out of the PT commands. I also have another letter, the Battle of Britain speech signed by Winston Churchill. And, of course, Churchill was Kennedy's hero as an orator. He watched Churchill speak. He also saw Hitler speak. So he understood the power of oratory to bring out the best or the worst in people. And so my mother has, you know, told me that war experience changed him as a person, really galvanized him to a life in politics. And, of course, he wasn't a natural public speaker. He was sickly as a child. But in 46, he comes out, runs in Cambridge, right in the district we're in, right, well, we're in Austin now, but close enough. And then he just works like crazy from then on to be president.
That's Stephen Kennedy Smith and Douglas Brinkley, who are the editors of this terrific new volume on JFK on the 100th anniversary of his birth. You know, one of the things also that struck me is humor, which I know is nothing new. We all know. But Chuck Todd, who's a regular guest with us on Thursdays, mentioned, I don't know, 6 months ago, 2 months ago, whatever it was, he said, you know, I've gone through a lot of video. I've never seen Donald Trump laugh anywhere, which really stuck with me. And then literally, as I'm thinking about humor last night, I happened to open to page 271. This is a speech Kennedy gives to the National Cultural Center dinner in November of 1962, the opening paragraph. In 1664, Louis XIV, in his own efforts to encourage the arts, donned brilliant tights and played in a drama called Furious Roland before a happy court. Moreover, he drafted the highest officers of his administration for the play, so that according to an account, all clad in brilliant tights themselves, they passed before the queen in their court, which is pretty amusing. And then the next line is, this was suggested tonight, but for some reason or other, the committee turned it down. And I can say, it's just, it's so engaging. And but that was a huge part of the allure. I mean, beyond the way they looked and the family and the whole deal. So, I mean, the humor was a huge part of who this man was.
One of my favorite comments is actually Martin Luther King's father said that he wouldn't vote for JFK because he was a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And President Kennedy said, imagine that, Martin Luther King's father, a bigot. Well, I guess we all have fathers, don't we?
That is a great line.
That is a great line. I hadn't heard that one one either. You know, Douglas Brinkley, I get, by the way, I should say the title of the book again, in this massive book. I mean, it is a beautiful, beautiful book, JFK, the Centennial Edition. I get nervous, and you're the historian, so I'm hoping you can assuage my fears, that that we may not have a courageous Republican and that something has sort of changed in the system and that you know, I've often said to Jim, you know, I wonder, doesn't Paul Ryan, for example, the Speaker of the House, is supposed to be so smart, even though I think he's too involved with the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and stuff. But doesn't he think about how history is going to remember him in this moment in time, or Mitch McConnell or other people? And I don't know, but I do worry that something has changed and that we are not going to fix ourselves. You have a much bigger perspective than I do. Am I crazy?
Well, you're not crazy. I always say, though, the point of history is to remind us that our own times aren't uniquely oppressive. And usually when we get in jams, we get ourselves out of them. I am dismayed when to think about this being a new McCarthy era. If you go back to Joe McCarthy, nobody would shut him up. Behind Joe McCarthy's back, they were all saying he's crazy, he's drunk. But to his face, Republicans wouldn't abandon him. Finally, it took the U.S. Army hearings to start really going after him. And then Dwight Eisenhower, once George Marshall had been attacked, his integrity attacked by Joe McCarthy, Ike came around to go after McCarthy. McCarthy then shriveled up as an ex-senator and died years afterwards as an alcoholic. All I'm saying is there is some Joe McCarthy in Donald Trump. What McCarthy used to do was claim he had names and lists and things. Turns out he never had these names or lists or things. The other day, Donald Trump said he had tapes of his conversations with Comey. I doubt he has tapes. He just says it. So there's that grandiose demagogic kind of character you get in Trump or McCarthy, and usually we find a way to flush them out of the system But it doesn't mean they don't do a lot of damage till we finally catch up with them.
You know, I'm a huge admirer of RFK, and Larry Tai was here, I don't know, 6 months ago after he wrote the Robert Kennedy, and talk about how all these men and women are so complicated. You mentioned McCarthy's what made me think of it. The piece where he writes about Robert Kennedy essentially sneaking anonymously to McCarthy's funeral in Wisconsin, I guess. And it's just, and the reporters allegedly went along, agreed not to out him, essentially, which got me to think, what's the underside as an historian to JFK? I mean, what are the things that you say, Douglas Brinkley, were his greatest failures, either as a man or as a president?
You know, there'd be more as a man than as a president. As a man, I think some of the evidence of his, the term used is womanizing. Mm-hmm. You know, became out of control, or at the very least, he put himself in situations that could be misconstrued at a number of circumstances. Today, he would have been outed for those. Reporters would have followed those trails. In those days, what one did with their personal lives was you really kept out of the presses.
Even if reporters knew it, they'd consider it pretty off bounds.
Even if reporters, people like Scotty Reston
used
to say, well, we heard and knew about some of this, but it wasn't our job to put it on the newspapers. Now the tabloids have taken over America, the tabloidization of serious news, that assuredly things like that would have leaked out. So that reckless element in him. But when he gets to the points of presidency, I think he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis well, the Berlin Wall crisis well. He did the nuclear test ban treaty, stopping the atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons, major accomplishment. He created institutions like the Peace Corps, the U.S. SEALs, the Green Beret. There could be an argument that Kennedy was going to get us into Vietnam because he had sent military advisors and CIA over. But there is no proof that we would have had a Vietnam War. That's Lyndon Johnson's war, where you start sending over 35,000, 50,000, 100,000 troops. There is no indication Kennedy was ready to do that. So I call it Lyndon Johnson's wars, not Kennedy. So my problem with Kennedy would be how he managed his personal life. And how reckless that could have been to his administration, if known.
You know, Marjorie asked Stephen before essentially what he learned about his uncle that he didn't know before. You're the historian. What did you learn in putting this thing together with Stephen that you didn't know about Kennedy before?
I did not realize how much he had done for the environmental movement.
Neither did I. The Cape Cod National Seashore. Yeah.
Well, not
did you
just
know
that,
this,
but
Stephen? I mean, you lived down the Cape.
No, I didn't. Yeah.
He did everything. He started fighting as a senator to save Cape Cod. It was a complicated deal to get done because in Chatham and Wellfleet, people were living in some of those communities. And he created this incredible national seashore there and then replicated it at South Padre Island, Texas, which is the biggest protected barrier island now in the world.
I did not know that.
And then he saved Point Reyes, which is if you go to Marin County,
yes,
where it's so
yes.
beautiful, all of that coastal area was saved by John F. Kennedy. Then he started pushing hard for clean air acts, clean river, pushed for wilderness, areas where no roads, no buildings could go. That finally got agreed to on its 66th draft in 1964, right after Kennedy died. But Jack Kennedy had been pushing for wilderness straight on through, and then he embraced Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which started making public health a big deal. So when you talk about 60s environmental movement, it's John F. Kennedy and the team of people around him who launches that movement. Big hero of that is the Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas from Washington State, who also was great friends with the Kennedy family. Old Joe Kennedy Sr. used to say, I don't know what it's wrong with me, but the two guys I trust most in public life I don't agree with all the time, Jack and Bill Douglas. You know? And both of them were more liberal, and both of them had things like on the environment. They were very keen on saving treasured landscapes and protecting public lands.
Stephen, you were going to say
something. Yeah, what I found very interesting is he gave a number of speeches on political extremism. Mm. And one of them is called Voices of Extremism, that's commented by E.J. Dionne, where he said at every period in our nation's history, there are those who've attempted to avoid their own responsibility by finding an appealing slogan or a convenient scapegoat. But in due course, the wisdom of the great American consensus has always prevailed. And so he had faith in American democracy. But I also found this quote from his last speech at the Dallas Trademark, which he did not get to give. In a world of complex and continuing problems, in a world full of frustrations and irritations, America's leadership must be guided by the lights of learning and reason. Otherwise, those who confuse rhetoric with reality and the plausible with the possible will gain popular ascendancy with their seemingly swift and easy solutions to every world problem.
Wow.
That isn't prophetic.
Prescient. Yeah.
You know, Stephen, while you read that last thing from the undelivered speech, the other things you've quoted from your uncle, you just quoted.
Yeah.
How much of what he spoke is in your head?
I have spent the last year, I'm like, people want to get away from me because I'm like a walking JFK. I mean, I am a real menace to society right now with Kennedy quotes, so I better let Doug do most of the talking.
Yeah, it's not a bad place to spend
but
your time.
Almost every one of them is applicable to something contemporary.
You know, it's also, when Marjorie mentioned how great the photographs were, many of which I haven't seen. I don't know. I assume some of them have never been seen publicly before. Even the first photograph in the book.
Oh,
talk about how
the little kids.
Quaint. There's a John Kennedy, I think it was in September when he was a candidate in 1960, preparing for a speech. And he's sitting there with a little couple of pieces of paper and a chair. And behind him, almost like in a movie, he's sitting in front of a window and standing in the window staring in. Or all these little children with smile on their face, like, or impishly, you know, saying, "Oh my God, there's the candidate for president." It was just,
yeah,
it really is so.
Caroline
beautiful.
Actually told me that was her favorite photo.
Is that
in the book.
I
yeah.
love that picture.
Yeah.
It's a great picture. There's a million great pictures. This is a real treat for anybody that is interested in history and John Kennedy and just that whole period of the 60s. It's a great book.
It's great.
Guys,
it's great.
Congratulations.
To see you both. Thank you so much for
to
doing
you both. Stephen Kennedy Smith and Douglas Brinkley's new book, JFK, A Vision for America. It's been published in commemoration of the centennial of President Kennedy's birth. Stephen, is the nephew of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Douglas Brinkley is professor of history at Rice University and fellow at the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, an emerging trend in cafe is doing away with free Wi-Fi to encourage conversation. It's happening in Canada. You want it to happen here? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie. And by the way, we forgot something. In addition to the wonderful work
that... Oh, I forgot it.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
In addition to the wonderful work Douglas Brinkley and Stephen Kennedy Smith did with this compilation of Vision for America, JFK, WGBH, to commemorate the 100th anniversary, is also collecting memories of our listeners. And if you go to WGBHnews.org, there is a place where you can record a memory or a thought about JFK, should you choose, WGBHnews.org. We only have a couple of minutes here because we were so consumed with the book we ran over. If you're among those who are considering fleeing to Canada, you might think twice if you take your coffee with free Wi-Fi. It turns out a number of cafes in Canada, I didn't know this till this weekend, are taking customers off the grid as a way of encouraging conversation instead. Some cafes are even going as far as doing away with comfy furniture and narrowing counters to make them less accommodating for laptops. And we're taking your calls. And again, we only have a few minutes asking you if this is what we need to come together as a society. 877-301-8970. You think you'd be more likely to chat someone up at a cafe if you and the others weren't online? Obviously, you would. Where and when do you find yourself more likely to engage with strangers? You know, this is one of these things where I'm a hypocrite because in the abstract, I say this is terrific because people should talk to each other more. And if it encourages it, which it clearly would by definition. But then if I ever went to a place that didn't have Wi-Fi, I'd probably leave and go to the place next door.
This is ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous?
Because I remember in the olden days before we had Wi-Fi and everybody had their little portable computers, you go sit in coffee shops and you'd read the paper, or you'd bring your book that you were reading, or I don't think you'd necessarily go to the coffee shop to chat it up with everybody in there. You kind of go
but
to
does
have
it
a
not drive
peace you, and quiet.
Does it not drive you nuts, though, when you go any place these days and every single head is down either into their phone or their computer?
What drives me nuts about it is people stay there for 2 hours and there's no seats.
Well, that's another reason. By the way, some cafes, including in my neighborhood in Cambridge, have a limit, which originally I was offended by. You can only do this for an hour if you're on your computer.
Yeah.
Because people just come. It's a workplace, essentially.
It's a workplace, yeah. And I think people get lonesome maybe in the house. They want to go out and work somewhere. But, I mean, you know, let people have their free Wi-Fi zones. They can all go in there and sing Kumbaya and hold hands.
Remember the great – you and I both love the movie Best in Show, one of the greats ever, ever about the Westminster Dog Show. But do you remember in the scene – I can't remember who played which parts – they were texting each other. That was the early days of texting. It was like 15 years ago. Across the street, they were in two different cafes across the street.
Starbucks.
From each
other. They were in
was
two different
it Starbucks, and they were texting at each other as they looked at each other.
At Starbucks, and that was how they reminisced about their where they met when they were talking to the therapist about their sex life.
But you know, it's totally
the dog.
I know I'm a hypocrite. Not sex with the dog. Not sex with the dog.
Well, the dog was attempting. Remember?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. But the reality is, people don't talk. I mean, that is. I know you think this is an artificial thing and it's phony, but people don't talk to each other. And I know I'm one of the worst culprits. I don't listen to my voicemail. I tell people to text me or send me an email. Yeah. I know I'm an abuser.
Well, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I used to go to this diner all the time in my hometown. I suppose if I sat at the counter, maybe I'd be talking to somebody.
Well, of course you would.
Well, no.
If you ride on a train, you love trains. I love trains. If someone's sitting next to you and you're not in your phone or your computer, you don't talk to the person next to you?
Are you kidding? I lived in dread of sitting next to somebody that was going to talk to me from coast to coast. Yes. And this is, like I said, long before everybody had texting and cell phones and all that kind of stuff. Although plane travel could be changing dramatically pretty soon.
I know, no laptops.
All the laptops on
Well, I still have phones. 877-301-8972. Do you think this is a good idea or it's an artificial kind of little scam by these cafe owners? By the way, it's not just in Canada. They've done it in a couple of places in the United States I read about, too. Sam and Akar, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, what's up?
It appears, I think this strikes me as something that where a cafe just doesn't want folks around all afternoon. I don't really think that any policy they implement can cause folks to, I don't know, to more readily engage with one another. That would require a more, I don't know.
So you think they're using as cover.
Yes.
They're basically saying it's to encourage conversation when it's purely a business proposition so there's more turnover.
Totally. If you look at
most
Starbucks, you have people sitting there all afternoon and there isn't that much seating. I think it's a way to get people moving.
That's quite true. Well, that ruins the conversation, but you're totally right.
I think a lot of the emails are saying the same thing. There's a lot of resentment out there for people hogging tables. It's almost as bad as the resentment between bicyclists and drivers. Daniel has a good point, though. He says, how are people supposed to look important if they can't be on their computer in Starbucks?
Yeah, but
you never get the next great American novel.
You know, even though, again, I have to be – the only reason I'm continually referring to myself as a hypocrite because I know you will if I don't, so I figure I'll beat you to it and preempt you. I know I don't like talking to strangers that much. We talk about that a lot on and off the air. But don't you think that one of the problems is of this time that nobody talks to anybody? I mean, literally and figuratively don't talk to anybody. There's almost no human contact that is not through a machine.
Well,
is that-
I mean, how many times do you actually call anybody up anymore? Everybody just texts.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I really resent it because it takes you so long to write the text. It's easier just to call and leave a message. But there's no point in calling and leaving a message.
Yeah, but there's
will listen to the message.
Well, but there's a real problem with calling someone. I don't want to sound
They might answer the phone.
They might answer the phone. Yeah, that has always been a concern of mine. And the way to avert that potential is – let's go to Jane Groton. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jane, thanks for the call. Hi.
Hi. Love you guys again.
Thanks.
Never had a problem where I couldn't find a seat to do computer. I don't like sitting at home all day because I'm working from supposedly home now. It's nice to go someplace, even if you don't talk to them, just have people around you. The problem I have is there are never enough plugs if I need one.
Oh.
So, but that's a different story.
Well, maybe that's intentional on their part, as per that first caller, too, is that's to discourage use and sitting there forever. That's possible.
People do sit there forever, and you know they haven't. Their coffee cup has been empty for quite some time. Pam says her dream would be to open a cafe that not only didn't have Wi-Fi access but banned talking on the phone, working at computers, etc. It would be called the Talking Cafe.
Oh. By the way, don't you hate it when people, when you're in a place like that and somebody's talking to somebody else? It's not like a library where you're supposed to shut up.
Phone?
But don't you, when you're in a coffee shop, I call it a cafe, I know it's affected. But if you're at a coffee shop and somebody's using the phone and talking to someone aloud, does that not drive you
it
nuts?
It drives me crazy.
No, you're making fun of me, or you just think
no, it does drive me crazy.
Drives me out of my mind.
It drives me much more crazy than someone having a regular conversation.
How about when someone's at the gym and is on a machine and they're on the phone? Yeah.
Really?
I took a picture of somebody about a year ago and tweeted it out just because I was hoping somebody would recognize the person was on a treadmill. And they were doing it for two reasons. One, to show off that they were cutting a big business deal.
Yeah.
And two, to show that they could be on the treadmill and speaking at the same time.
I'm on the phone when I'm walking the dog.
Yeah. You know what I did?
What?
Keyed their car after the I didn't think you were paying attention, so I had to say that to see if...
Of course I was paying attention, Jim. I always pay attention.
So unfortunately, we're out of time here, but we hope to give you something to think about. Or
We are out of time. But we got a lot to talk about with Bob Thompson, our TV man, the return of Twin Peaks. And he'll give us his take on the much-anticipated series, plus his best and worst TV moments of the week. That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy. That's me and Marjorie Egan. In this postmodern era where life goes way beyond imitating art, can Saturday Night Live effectively parody what seems to be a self-parodying administration, and in particular, a self-parodying press secretary?
All right, let me just put this whole Russian thing to bed once and for all. Trump is innocent. How do we know? Because he told us so. Period. Okay, then he hired lawyers to agree with him. And they're going to prove it with a certified letter, which you know is the truth because it costs an extra $2 to have it certified.
Melissa McCarthy, Saturday night. Joining us on the line for his take on this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob is a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hi to both of you.
Hey, Bob Thompson. I'm so glad we're talking to you about Saturday Night Live because I have some mixed feelings about this. As funny as Melissa McCarthy is, and the funniest thing I thought of all was her driving the podium through the streets of Manhattan. I thought that was hysterical. I'm not laughing an awful lot at some of the other stuff.
No, I thought it was yet another, after an incredible week of news, I think it's demonstrating that in this particular political climate with these particular political actors, the mode of comedy dealing with politics is not so much being effectively done by parody, the likes of the President Show on Comedy Central and Saturday Night Live, and I think it's being much more effectively done by these investigative comedians like Samantha Bee, John Oliver, Trevor Noah, Seth Meyers in the first part of his show. It seems like what's been going on in the news is much more effectively analyzed by those types of comedians than simply putting people in makeup and exaggerating their physical and verbal tics.
You left off Stephen Colbert. Has he sort of faded from the scene after his...
I guess I would put Colbert on that list as well. I mean, Colbert does Trump imitations, but he's not doing... I mean, Saturday Night Live, when you get right down to it, it is still doing what it did way, way back when it started, which was, remember, Chevy Chase doing...
Yep.
I guess that was an impersonation of Gerald Ford, although you could have fooled me.
You know, even though I agree with the mixed reviews you and Marjorie are both giving, I'm sort of mourning the fact that I didn't know till, I guess, Saturday night when I saw that The Rock was hosting next week, that it was the final episode of the season, which means it won't be around for a while. So is The Rock, I know he said he might run for president in 2020, which has us all,
who knows, Jim?
All a
who
tingle.
Knows?
Is he the right guy in this political season to be hosting the final? I know he's huge, but is he the right guy?
Well, it's... It's interesting that you bring, I mean, GQ just came out with this big article that by the time you're done reading it, you're convinced that not only will The Rock run, but he'll win as well. I mean, it's a very convincing thing about how The Rock has managed to, and I guess we should now call him Dwayne Johnson, that The Rock was
correct.
His wrestling name, but he's managed to find himself in a little space in the culture as a guy that everybody across the board seems to really like. And you can't find many of those people. There's Tom Hanks and I'm not sure who else. Maybe Jennifer Lawrence, but there's people who don't like her. So it is very interesting that in the end of a season where we've got this celebrity president who became most famous on a reality TV show and all of that, that the final episode of the season will be hosted by somebody who people are now looking in the rearview mirror as the next celebrity president.
I think Tom Hanks and Jennifer Lawrence should run for president, too. We're at it. Why not? We're talking to Bob Thompson. What's your best of the week, Bob?
Well, we don't have to talk about this too long because it was my what to watch last week.
Oh, Master of None?
Master of None on Netflix. It was such a great first season. I was so excited for the second one. It opened this week and didn't disappoint. A totally different kind of show than the first season. Every episode, in fact, is like an independent little gem. But it's really a fine show. I highly recommend those who haven't seen it yet to watch it. But with one proviso and warning.
What?
The very first episode of the first season is, I think, the weakest one of the whole bunch. So don't give up if you don't like the first one. Give it a couple more. Matter of fact, the second one is really quite beautiful.
You know, I am so excited about this because I think this guy Ansari is so funny. And he's
too.
Got his real parents in there playing them real
who are
self.
Also hilariously.
Hilarious.
They're really good.
His dating travails and his food travails and looking for Ms. Wright in the right restaurant. I mean, the whole thing. I'm so excited about it. We have a clip from it, actually, for those who haven't seen it, to get a little taste of Masters of None. Here, this is when he plays Dev. Aziz Ansari, plays Dev. And in this scene, he's complaining about appeasing his parents' religious expectations.
They make you go to mosque as a kid?
Yeah, we'd go for the big holidays. I remember when my mom took me for the first time, I thought I was going to see that Jim Carrey movie, The Mask. Then we end up at the mosque. Not exactly the same. Ugh, they're still doing it. My mom wants me to go to this Eid prayer this weekend. Can I bail?
Dude, just go.
Why?
Because you got to compromise. I mean, just throw them a bone every now and then. Remember when Q and I got married? My parents wanted us to have some four-hour Hindu ceremony with some random priest from Queens. We just said fine, but in return, we played 100% rap at the reception, explicit versions.
You know, by the way, when you're not watching the video, it sounds like it could be an animated feature, by the way. The
you
voices.
Know, I was just thinking that. I hadn't noticed that before, but you're right. There is that kind of acting style that very much sounds like that. You're right.
We're talking about Thompson. What's the worst? There's so much to choose from.
That, by the way, was the third episode of the new season and really nails a lot of this, subject of religion in just an effortless and fun kind of way. I guess I brought that up because I'm delaying the worst. But here we go.
Yeah. What is it?
I think I still have to stick with giving it to Anderson Cooper's eye roll scene round the world. Though at times it wouldn't take long to convince me that that was the best. But I do believe that journalists are really in need of coming up with new vocabulary, new categories, and new strategies to treat covering the national scene now, which is so filled with people telling them stuff that isn't true. But I just am not sure whether resorting to rolling the eyes is the way to do it.
Here's Kellyanne Conway. By the way, was it Kellyanne Conway and her explanation of switching?
And she deserved the eyes to be rolled at.
Switching positions on the part of her boss, the president, that caused Cooper his now infamous eye roll. She said on Fox and Friends she thought it might be sexist. Here she is.
Hillary Clinton is in search of sexism as a lame excuse for why her disastrous candidacy and campaign lost. 6 months ago, I face sexism a lot of times when I show up for interviews like that. Could you imagine rolling your eyes, having a male anchor on a network roll eyes at Hillary Clinton, at somebody, a female representative spokeswoman for President Obama or President Bill Clinton? I think not.
You sound like you're on the fence about this, Bob, but you can go either. What's yours?
She must have missed Jeffrey Toobin rolling his eyes nonstop at Alan Dershowitz, an esteemed professor at
when
the
Law School.
When they're
both sitting on the set next to each other.
Yes.
Well, and didn't she also... saying sexism, which I think she's probably right. There are journalists who are more likely to roll their eyes at women than at men, but you're right. We've seen them roll them at women. But then didn't she make the argument that they would never have rolled them at Hillary Clinton, who is a woman? I didn't quite get the whole, but then again, there's a lot of things that Kellyanne Conway says that I don't quite get.
You know, I have to say I'm with Marjorie on this, and it may be because I have a pro Anderson Cooper bias because I love him, but I watch a lot of CNN. And one of the diseases that has infected CNN is they obviously have been instructed by the bosses. You have to be really, really tough on everybody from the Trump administration. And when you have somebody, and I say this with all due respect, which is not very respectful, of limited intelligence like Chris Cuomo, like when he tries to be really tough, it is so transparent. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but, you know, I think Anderson Cooper's credibility is so clearly established that I'm with Marjorie. I think it's just what it is. But, you know, there's another example. I'm sure you've heard about this, that Chris Matthews is taking some crap for what he said about Sally Yates the day after the former acting attorney general testified. Let's hear what he had to say. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on this. Here's Matthews, obviously, on MSNBC's Hardball.
In playing defense, Trump does the distraction thing, talking about unmasking over and over again, talking about leaking over and over again, talking about Yates as some sort of partisan tool. I have to say that just watching her today, I wouldn't want to be against her. She's unflappable, attractive, obviously, very well spoken, a nice southern accent, standing up there right in the face of Ted Cruz when Cruz was being, I thought, pretty nasty.
Well, she did deep six Cruz, I thought, brilliantly. But the attractive, the nice southern accent thing has gotten a number of people, not including Marjorie, I should say, giving Chris Matthews a lot of crap. What did you think of it?
Right. Attractive, obviously. He even adds the obviously. And didn't Chris Matthews get into some trouble talking about Melania doing a beauty pageant walk or something? And he made some comments about that. I mean, yes, I think compared to an eye roll, that is worse. But I guess the difference I see is that it's Chris Matthews who kind of does this sort of stupid stuff every now and again. Not to say that that's good. Whereas, as you were pointing out with Anderson Cooper, he is got the established credentials. He is, you know, seen as one of the people that may be staying focused during all of this. And I get back to the idea that I do think that journalists need to come up with new ways of dealing with having to encounter some of what they're encountering. But the eye roll brings us back to a strategy that has nothing to do with rationality, nothing to do with a focused argument. There's something about an eye roll that is so childish, and it reminds me of some of the stuff that's coming from who they're talking to that's just as childish.
They might be better off just saying, that isn't true. With due respect, that is not true. Or with due respect, that is not a fact. Because you're right about the eye rolling. I don't think Chris Matthews...
But the only good news about all this is in light of the fact if yesterday is any indication and the president is not sending any representatives to any of the Sunday talk shows, we don't have to worry about eye rolls anymore. So things could be resolved. So Jill Soloway, who obviously people know from being a creator of Transparent, has a new show, I Love Dick, which is getting a lot of play. What's your take of this?
Yeah, it sounds good.
It is. I watched all 8 episodes in a row. It's only 30 minutes each long. Mm-hmm. Actually, some of them are considerably less than that, so you can plow through this. It is quite an oddment. When I think of where television was a mere 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, I could never have imagined a thing like this playing on any cable or any place else. It's very kind of experimental. It's based on a novel that was all cult. All kinds of people from academia were attracted to it and all the rest of it. It's a really weird 30-minute show, by no means a comedy, though I think she sometimes calls it that. It takes place in Marfa, Texas, in this tiny West Texas town with all these artists and academics who come and spend time at this institute. And Kevin Bacon plays what amounts to the Marlboro Man.
Mm. Yeah,
who runs the institute and is also a visual artist and sculptor and rich. I forgot to tell you that.
Well, I love Kevin
Bacon.
But
he walks like the Marlboro Man and he rolls his own cigarette.
Oh, yeah.
And he rides a horse and wears a cowboy hat.
Oh, good. So we should definitely check it out then.
But it is very, I mean, it's a, there are women executive producing and writing and directing. It's based on material written by women. It is very much something that attempts to go into a lot of the territory of what academics call the male gaze and shift that to the female gaze. Lots of Kevin Bacon walking around with no shirt on. It is really, really interesting, but it's probably not for everybody.
You know, one of the things... I haven't seen it yet, and I'm actually anxious to see it, more anxious to see it after having heard your review. I really love the 30-minute television show these days, and maybe because it's rarer and rarer, maybe because I'm busier and busier, but when I get something that really says what it needs to say
in
28 minutes, I feel, like, uplifted in some ways.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the best, by far the best new series of the 2016-17 season, the season that is just now ending, was FX's Atlanta, 30-minute show. Master of None, I've been raving about for 2 weeks now, 30 minutes, sometimes shorter show. I think there really is now emerging all the great hour-long dramas that started with The Sopranos and have been going on for a long. I think the 30-minute drama, or the 30-minute whatever we want to call it, is really coming into its own. And I'm not talking about Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but these kinds of shows that we've just been mentioning now.
You think it's because there's so much on TV and people are so busy that there's a niche for this now, or what do you think it is?
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but it's that's a good point. You can actually binge something
like you
I
did.
Love Dick, and you can do it all in one sitting without losing your job and having social services come in and take your kids away.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from. By the way, I want to introduce this next topic. I watched American Idol maybe twice ever. Marjorie would come in like a teeny bopper to our old radio show, like every time it was on, trying to describe the whole hour or whatever it was to me.
Because
why did you love the show so much?
First of all, my kids were young then, and it was sort of event watching. And the best part, of course, Bob, was at the beginning when they have these people come out who couldn't put two notes together that sang off key, and they would have birds on their shoulders and weird outfits, and you'd have Simon Cole there. Talk about rolling eyes. You know, I mean, the whole thing was just so funny. And then, of course, you get swept up into the end. It was like the NBA playoffs, but they were in on who was going to win American Idol. So I loved it. I'm not sure I'd like it coming back.
And we should say that's what we're talking about, is ABC is bringing it back after it was canceled by Fox. What's the deal?
Give us a scoop.
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, I'm with you, Marjorie, on this one. For the first three or four seasons, that was really fun television.
It was.
And you're right. It was two shows. The first part was watching these people who thought the world owed them a career as rock star, even though they couldn't never practice or didn't take any lessons.
Yeah.
That was really funny and satisfying. And then, of course, it became an old-fashioned Major Bowes original amateur hour, let's put on a show kind of thing.
Yep.
So I thought that show really worked. I think it was getting a bit old. But ABC has brought it back. I think it was a wise move on their part. That show left Fox not that long ago, a couple seasons ago. However, and its ratings had been plummeting. They were going down by large percentages per season. But still, even when it left the air at its lowest point, a bad episode of American Idol, a low-rated episode of American Idol, was still higher ratings than most other shows on the air. So I think ABC is thinking, okay, there's been a little detox period. It's been off for a while. They're really trying to bring this back to make it look as much like the original as before, trying to get Ryan Seacrest, in spite of the fact that he's got seven other jobs to do, to host it again. Looks like they might have Katy Perry to be one of the judges. And ABC doesn't have a whole lot of those live kinds of things. I think it's a very good fit for them.
And Ryan Seacrest, he was just signed by ABC, was he not, to do the Kelly show?
He's in the ABC family doing the Kelly Ripa. He's now her co-host. But it's given that commitment and all the other sorts of things, and that probably American Idol, when it starts in March – is going to be on two nights a week. That would be quite a juggling act for him.
Let me tell you something. Marjorie would never make it into work the next day. So what do we want? What's to watch in the week ahead there, Bob?
Well, this is an easy one. Sunday, yes. 9 o'clock,
yes.
The first two episodes of The Twin Peaks Return.
You know, before we even talk about this for a minute, and I am up there with people who love Twin Peaks, to me, Fargo is almost Twin Peaks. I know we talked about Fargo and whether or not it was going to sort of jump the shark or whatever that expression is. I think season three is fabulous. We're through four episodes. But isn't there a Twin Peaksian kind of thing to Fargo?
Very
with
much so. Not only Twin Peaksian, but I think it's even better. Fargo stands on the shoulders of Twin Peaks. It's kind of like Hill Street Blues revolutionized American television in incredibly significant ways. But then if you watch The Wire's a lot better than Hill Street Blues. That's because The Wire owes a lot to what Hill Street Blues did.
Yeah.
I think the same is true of Fargo. There would have been no Fargo without Twin Peaks. There'd have been no Lost without Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks started this whole, I hate to overuse word surreal, but that whole thing. And Fargo is able to do what it does because Twin Peaks is humming in the background, as you point out, in every episode, in practically every scene of that, which then leaves us to, so we can enjoy Twin Peaks by going back and watching it and remembering what a brilliant new show it was. We can enjoy Fargo for taking the Twin Peaks aesthetic and bringing it to glorious new spaces, but do we want to go back and remake Twin Peaks? Is it going to work? And I have very modest expectations for what I'm going to see on Sunday.
Bob Thompson, is the theme song the same?
Has to be.
I hope so.
Because that to me was at least 50% of the show.
There's 18 hours, 18 episodes. This week and next week, you'll see two in a row, and then I think they go to 1 hour per week for a total of 18. And my understanding is that David Lynch directed every one of them. And if you go back and watch the old Twin Peaks, the Lynch-directed episodes were always far and away the best ones.
I watched a trailer this morning, which is indicative of nothing, but it got me really excited.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's nostalgia or because the trailer was great, but I am
Were there any strains from the theme song or no?
I don't remember. Okay. I was just so excited. Hey, Bob,
Oh, always fun. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Bob Thompson joins us.
Watching Fargo, by the way? Are you watching Fargo? It is spectacular.
Okay,
I mean,
it's really
spectacular.
Is everybody's head getting chopped off?
No, nobody is. No, I know you don't like violence. There's no horrible violence. Well, actually, there's one scene that is a little hard for you to take.
Yeah,
but other than that.
Okay, because last time I watched it, it was like, it was basically a bloodbath every week.
Spoiler alert, an air conditioner falls out a window and someone happens to be under the window.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
So that is a little tough to take.
But it was quick.
It was quick. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
But it's okay. Bob Thompson joins us every Monday. He is the founding director of the Blyar Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. That is it for us today, Jim.
Yes,
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Mayor Marty Walsh. He'll join us at 12:30 at our studio at the Boston Public Library. If you want to see Marty Walsh, come on down. We have one of those microphones down there, too, don't we? You can ask your questions in person.
Yes, you can.
I want to thank the crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski. What's so funny?
One of those microphones.
Molly, that's right. We're really high tech.
One of them, our microphones
exactly.
We got down there.
Molly Boygon, and our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Jim Browdy, what is on the soon to be award-winning Greater Boston?
So the ransomware cyber attack, everybody knows, hit British hospitals, Russian banks, car manufacturers, now FedEx. How vulnerable are we, particularly in a smart city like Boston? Two big-time experts are going to join me. Speaking of big-timers, the president of the Red Sox, Sam Kennedy, and a terrific guy who we both think very warmly of, Robert Louis Jr., is a community leader, founder of The Base, which is this urban youth baseball program that does help kids through sports and all aspects of their life. Want to discuss the climate of diversity in baseball at all levels, what they're doing about it, fans, players, etc. Obviously, in the wake of what happened at Fenway a couple weeks ago, we're doing that. Jared's got a little piece, and I have a commentary. It's going to be quite a fine show, I would say.
That sounds very enticing, Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow. And even though it's pouring today, it's going to get nice for the rest of the week.
Oh, is it ever.
Thanks.